on.
Good morning.
This is Wednesday, November 20th, 2013, and I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. I am, for the first time, sitting behind the chair sign here, and I'm going to be running a fairly full-looking meeting here, set up by the outgoing chair, Representative Dembro. And so we're going to try to stick to the schedule fairly closely. We've got 20 to 30 minutes allotted for each of the items on the agenda, and I'm going to steal just a couple before we start to say how much I have appreciated soon-to-be Senator Dembro's guidance and passion and fervor on behalf of students and what he thinks is right, and I tend to agree with him most of the time, on behalf of what this committee has been charged with. I think that you've steered us through some really challenging times and topics, and you'll continue to do that. I'm happy to have you here for the last little bit of this meeting. You're going to take off around 10, is that correct, and head down to your new home there?
Yes, but I promise I'll come back to visit, sir.
All right. Any other comments about the outgoing chair, outgoing representative?
Is this a roast?
Well, he's got a target on him. Mini roast, maybe. Representative Greenlee.
I would like to take a second to tell how much I appreciate the work he's done and how he's included us and things that have been involved. And these have been very difficult issues, but you leave a great deal of goodwill behind as you go to the wrong side of the building.
Thank you, sir. And can I just say just really how much I've...
No. Yes. Senator, Representative.
All right. There's a new sheriff in town, folks. How much I've really appreciated this committee. It's been such a high-performing committee. And yet, at the same time, you know, very civil, and you know, I think we accomplished a lot, and I'm sure you will continue to accomplish a lot because you are in very capable hands now. Well, you're still in very capable hands, Victoria Cox. Chair Harker is going to do a great job, and good luck.
Thanks, Rep. Johnson.
I was just wondering what one wears to a coronation. I don't know if I'll meet the dress code. So we'll have to see how that works.
All right. Enough said. On to the first agenda item then. It's open an informational hearing on issues of concern to the Latino community. And call up Alfonso Lopez Vasquez and Maria Alanis Ruiz, please.
Apologies first to the way that our statement was crafted to thank Chairman Dembro, outgoing Chairman Dembro. Thank you for the opportunity. Chairman Harker, thank you for the opportunity. And lady and gentlemen, thank you for the opportunity of being here. I don't know how often times you have listened to the voice of Latinos, Hispanics, Chicanos, and other populations, but I welcome the opportunity to do so. Before I make my formal comments, I would like to, number one, acknowledge the fact that even though we're here, and I am here, to voice challenges and opportunities for Hispanics in higher education and workforce development, that as we look forward, that we also acknowledge the challenges that we still have in responding to the needs of our African-American community, our Native American community, and other communities, particularly the immigrants who are coming in and finding challenges in the educational system. I have three papers that I am trying to capture into one paper, and my apologies for not having written testimony. The last time I presented testimony was in the great state of Kansas back in 1977. So it's a relatively newer experience for me. But the first one is a statement, positional statement from a colleague, Clark Peters, who has been a long-time educator, a graduate of Pacific University, and very active in issues of equity. He is currently serving as a volunteer coordinator of the Equity and Diversity Initiative for the PTA of Oregon. And I respect him dearly. But he encapsulates six critical points most of which are we will be responding, addressing in more detail. One of them is the significant underrepresentation of Latinos in higher education, of Latinos in the workforce in a meaningful way in professional careers. The fact that those of us who have come into the system have oftentimes done so at the expense of language and culture that has been not only not validated, but oftentimes rejected in education and in the workforce. We have a significant underrepresentation of Latinos in higher education as faculty, staff, and administration. Staff, I would have to qualify that because if we look at food services and custodial services and other areas, we are overrepresented in that arena. And therefore, our voices are there. Our voices in leadership are significantly underrepresented in higher education. The history, culture, and tradition of Latinos is seldomly presented in higher education, and thus a void in the opportunities. If higher education and workforce development are to meet future societal needs and expectations of Latinos and other language ethnic communities, significant changes are going to have to be made to the system, a system that is all too often stagnant and set up on its own ways and is driven by a set of values that is incongruent with cultural democracy. It is our belief that we must start planning now for the long-term sustainability of our economy, and it has to be done in a way that minorities are properly represented. The second paper is Alfonso's cry for social justice and equity, borrowing on the concept of a country's values of democracy. And I call it cultural democracy in education, a prerequisite for opportunities. In this paper, I try to summarize the scholarship that has been written concerning the inequities in education, but focus more on the positive elements of what we need to do. The biggest challenge is the fact that most of the initiatives that have been part of higher education and education in general to address the inequities have been based on the deficit model. The deficit model that looks at language and culture as being our deficit, and that we must first discard that before we become assimilated. I consider myself to be a product of the war on poverty, but I call myself a survivor because I did not assimilate. I became a Chicano, and Chicano gave me the source of pride of who I was and who I became, both as a Mexican, as an immigrant, as a Mexican-American, and trying to be an American as much as I possibly can to be a contributor. In this paper, I wanted to focus specifically on the scholarship of Professor Austin, who wrote a powerful book in 1982 entitled Minorities in Higher Education, in which he outlined three simple concepts of what we needed to do in higher education and education in general. Number one, as we look at teaching, a major function of education is research in the neurosciences, in particularly when he was running this work, has opened windows of opportunity. A lot of scholarship work has been going on about learning styles on different populations, yet we minimally introduce those as we look into the practice of teacher education. Research, one of the major functions of higher education. Sadly enough, a lot of the research in higher education has oftentimes been the label that has been affixed on minorities has given us the labels of being disadvantaged. If we increase the representation of minorities in the research arena, the voice, the mindset, the values, and our understanding of society, not only our own culture, but the culture of society, we can become significant contributors to this great country and this great state. And service. A lot of the service initiatives in higher education are really designed to give predominantly Anglo students an opportunity to work with those other people. Latinos can become ambassadors to create a better culture. And the third paper is the paper that is more grounded on my work at Pacific University. My position, I am the director of diversity and assistant professor at Pacific University. We have developed a comprehensive diversity initiative guided by the American Association of Colleges and Universities. My apologies. My mouth is getting dry. It must be the nervousness. But the American Association of Colleges and Universities crafted a very comprehensive initiative in the aftermath of the Supreme Court cases on the Michigan affirmative action issues. Thank you very much. There were five different points that are listed. They had to be integrated into the academy to become meaningful and significant. Number one is leadership. The degree to which leadership has diversity. Diversity of voice, diversity of thoughts, diversity of gender. It's extremely important to provide guidance to the system. Number two is curriculum. The degree to which the curriculum is reflective of the diversity of the learners that they're trying to recruit. That the curriculum that empowers and enables diverse populations to become a voice in the process. The third component is student development. Student development is a means by which we can promote retention in our academy. We have a lot of students right now that if we were to bring them back to higher education because they dropped out, we could make a significant dent in providing opportunities for those populations. Pre-college education is extremely important, and even though we're supposed to talk about higher education, higher education has a major role in promoting equity by engaging the community. The fourth component is faculty and staff development. We have a significant challenge there because we have not created a pathway to increase the representation of minorities. And the fifth component is community university development. Higher education has a function of service, and that function needs to be developed in a way that is congruent with the needs of the community and to empower the Latino community as a foundation. I will provide these copies for the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Buenos dias, good morning, Chair Representative Dembro and Representative Harker, and members of the Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee. My name is Maria Alanis Ruiz, and I am the Interim Director for the Educational Talent Search at Portland Community College, Rock Creek. Formerly, I was the director, the director of the Chicano Latino Studies at Portland State University. I work at Portland State University for 30 years. I retire. In the mid-70s, along with Representative Gallegos, I helped to establish the Colegio Cesar Chavez in Mount Angel, Oregon. At that time, Colegio Cesar Chavez was the only independent Latino college in the country. That was in 1975. Much has changed, but little that we see the changes now. And what I mean is, when I was at Portland State University, I worked for 30 years. When I started, I can count the faculty and staff with my fingers. And today, 30 years later, is the same amount. So we have not changed that much. In those days, Latino students were not graduating from other institutions of higher education in Oregon. Nearly 50% were not graduating from high school. Today, that rate is down to 40%. Still, nearly half of the students of Latino descent are not graduating from high school. Those are, they are unable to advance in college. We appeal to the committee to address this issue of college readiness for Latino students. Once Latino students reach our college and universities, they are met with few students like themselves. They are often first generation without family socialization and values to help them to succeed in college. They are not role models. Sometimes we have to, for our students, we have to have role models to give us that incentive to continue. And that's by my experience too. They are often working. They seldom encounter instructors and professors who share their culture. Even more infrequently do they see academic directors or administrators who are also Latino. Similar Latino faculty seldom encounter other Latino faculty and often have difficulty with the self-promotion of mainstream academic culture. We have a hard time to be promoted. This different set of standards when we come into tenure. We don't have too many professors in tenure track or tenure, full tenure. So we need a lot of help on that. We have come a long ways since 1973 when Bilingual Education Act was passed. Bilingual education has evolved greatly in the past 40 years. It is no longer a simple supplement for non-English speakers. speakers. It is recognized as an education component that enhances the learning of all participants. English education provides critical foundation that will help all students proceed to college. Programs like Future Connect, of which you will hear more about later, are also vital. Once our students get to college, to provide the support system to assure retention. In my experience being as an admissions counselor and associate director of admissions, we saw a revolving door. We will bring the students, the Latino students, but we didn't have the services to retain them. So we kind of see a revolving door on that. Workforce development also implies that we prefer students in our communities for meaningful and well-paying employment opportunities in the trade. Only by providing opportunities for training and education can we address the disparities that exist in our health system, correction system, and welfare system. This opportunity to succeed is that our community need that we ask the committee support. Finally, in a summary, we appeal to the committee to recognize the significant changes in demography in the state of Oregon. Latinos comprise only 2% of the state population in 1975. Today, the group represents 12%. In many of the grade schools throughout the state, Latino students are over 50% of the student population. It is imperative that our institutions of higher education are prepared to welcome and retain this promise of the future. Thank you very much for listening. And I'm sorry I have to read it, but I get nervous.
It's okay. Well done. Thank you both very much for being here and bringing these issues to us. Some of them we are familiar with. I'm certainly not as familiar with all of the details that you presented here today. Thank you for all the work you've done so far and for egging us on. Are there questions or comments here? Yes, Representative Wisner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation and the information. I didn't bring the article with me, but I thought I read recently that the success of Hispanics in colleges has improved. And my question to both of you is, your testimony came from the public and the private. Do you see a difference?
From being from the private, so I think that we are pretty much par with the public institutions. If we look at the demographics of enrollment and success for Latinos in particular, changes started to happen in the 80s with the establishment of the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities that became a voice for public policy and resources to invest in improving the quality of education. And you have seen those changes happening somewhat. I think that public universities, by virtue of the function of being servants of the state, should have better results in the outcomes. And we have, I think, an area of opportunity. I would like to recommend two things. Number one, and one of our colleagues has made that request, we have enough people in college and university Latinos who can be the voices of some of the more complex issues. And he requested to the governor a year and a half ago when we met with them that he commissioned Latino scholars to put together position papers addressing the multiple challenges and propose solutions. The other one is to create an ongoing process that includes Latinos in higher education and K-12 education in a more systematic way to become, again, advisors, advocates of policies and procedures and practices.
Okay, Egos, and then Representative.
I just want to thank you both for your testimony. What was important, I think, is to get your words on record and make sure then that we follow through on some of these recommendations. Thank you.
Greenley?
Yes, thank you for your presentation. I just had the opportunity to review our 10-year struggle to get tuition equity, starting from my first session in 2003, where we came this close, and it took us a decade. We have narrow focus, you may have said. Would you recommend, what's the one thing we should be focusing on, say, beginning in 2015? What's the one thing what's the next thing that's important in the same way tuition equity was important up till now?
to validate and recognize the linguistic and cultural competencies that the learners bring to the table and value them to the point that they can become the next ambassadors of social justice in higher education, because higher education provides a passport to become, shall we say, the leaders of guiding where higher education ought to be.
If I may follow. That's an important cultural change in the higher education community.
Dramatic.
That's necessary. But what can we as legislators do? I mean, what do we need to add to the statutes or change something that will be important for the future?
Not knowing the full spectrum of duties and responsibilities and those that are delegated to the state education bodies, I think expecting and demanding accountability in the workforce of higher education, expecting and demanding accountability for enrollment patterns, retention and attrition issues, and demanding accountability for the performance of higher education in teaching, research, and scholarship that is so much part of higher education. This, to me, is accountability function.
Can I make one more comment?
Following this gentleman here.
Yes, thanks, Chair Harker. Actually, Professor Lopez-Vasquez kind of took what I was going to say, stole what I was going to say. We have recently adopted a process of achievement compacts that we're expecting of our public universities. And so, you know, it sounds as if you might be suggesting that some of the metrics of those achievement compacts include you know, progress on meeting some of the goals that you're talking about. For example, the number of faculty who are from minority backgrounds and some of the other achievement kind of components. Would that be fair to say?
Correct. If we look at the NCATE, National Council for the Accreditation of Teacher Education, of which many Oregon schools are part of and the state standard for teacher preparation are driven by, the diversity component, even though oftentimes overlooked or minimally integrated, gives you specific guidance as to what do we need to do. Number one is that candidates for teacher education, number one, must be taught by a faculty that is representative of diversity. Number two, that the student body that students interact with is likewise, and that they then become also actively involved in the educational process so that they can become the next academic leaders.
Rep. Gallegos, and then let's move on to the next subject.
I just want to make sure that, you mentioned Colegio Cesar Chavez was mentioned earlier, and that was back in 73, 75, somewhere in there. But as I was looking at some of the archival data and a problem statement that we wrote for a PPSI grant, there was a list of faculty. And I was very surprised to see a young firebrand activist called Mitch Greenlick was listed as one of the faculty. So, thank you.
That firebrand is a little dull.
Still burning, though.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we will close the informational hearing on issues of concern to the Latino community and other communities as expressed, and open an informational hearing on CTE revitalization. And I'd like to call, I think we have Brian Krieg and Laura Roach. Come and address us, please. Whenever you're ready.
Chair Parker.
Surprise.
Member of the committee and outgoing member, Representative Dembrough. I think it's really somehow very appropriate that we would be bringing CTE up at this particular hearing, as it's being Representative Dembrough's last one here as a champion of this issue. We're glad he's not leaving the building. We'll put it that way. It's
as
very
are we.
Important for us all on it. Good day. Brian Krieg. Today I am here as the co-chair of the CTE Grant Revitalization Committee. I'm co-chair. And I'd like to give you a brief overview of where we're at with the process from the grants that you helped fund and expanded upon during the last session. As we know, we started in 2011 with a modest of amount, about $2 million, to help get CTE jump started in the state. During the last session, in aggregate between the different bills, there's about $10 million in that area. We have about $8.8 million for the particular grants that we're going to talk about today, which are the large ones to the schools. We had a very, very strong response to the RFP. The RFPs were due at the end of October. Wide distribution across the state of applicants from it, all sizes of schools, from little ones to big ones. There was a great amount of anticipation and excitement in the education community about this round of grants. Laura Roach will have a very nice handout for you here that will go through the numbers, and I'll let her do that. But what I wanted to note is a few things about the committee that we have. The Grant Advisory Committee has about 16 folks on it, half from education, half from business and industry. We did a lot of things in preparation for the grants. We learned from the first cycle in 2011. We were able to implement I think a little bit more rigorous grant, a little more defined for the applicants. The first one was we were a little fuzzy on the edges on that one. We were able to provide a lot more in the way of resources also this time around to help the grant applicants in their writing of the grants. Laura will talk about that a little bit too. A lot of meetings, webinars, other things. And then for the review process, the initial review process, because we had a lot of grants in, we needed many, many more people than we had on the advisory committee to do this task and have at least three people look at each grant. And a distribution of that, we had 48 people that were involved in the grant review. Over a third were from business and industry. We had people from labor unions. We had people from corporations here in the state helping out on that process. Lengthy process. Every volunteer who was involved with that spent a minimum of 20 hours on that with reviews and webinars for the reviewers, and then an all-day meeting here in Salem going over some of the scorings. There's still more to go in the process. We're looking at it's about the end of the year, roughly, when the awards will be announced on that and all. So at that point, I'm going to turn it over to Laura and let her tell you the great numbers and some of the details we have.
Good morning. I'm Laura Roach. I'm the director of the Secondary Post-Secondary Transitions Team in the Department of Education. Thank you, Representative Harker and Dimbro and members of the committee, for your support of career and technical education. We did have a very passionate group of applicants in the pool, and we had a passionate group of readers that have reviewed those grants. If you can see here, we had $21.6 million in request for funding for CTE. And I think that what has come from this committee and this leadership is truly a revitalization interest in reviving career and technical education. I think the need for support is evident through this request. We had 62 applications, and as he indicated, Brian indicated, they were from across the state. 593 partners were identified, and that has been the foundation of this grant process. How will you do this work with your business and industry and education partners? So in some cases in the rural areas, that's more challenging. They don't have as many partners to choose from or to solicit, but we thought that was an outstanding number to be identified. 328 high schools were identified in each of these grants, and some of them were multiple schools and multiple grants. They could enter more than one grant request, and there was always a post-secondary partner that also was a foundation, so the community colleges are involved in this process. We embedded in this request the opportunity to further merge STEM and career and technical education, and of the $21 million in grants, 16.7 referenced STEM education, and I think you can see the marriage very easily there. And the other was career and technical education student organization. Whoo, these acronyms get long sometimes. They also were embedded in $18.1 million in grants. So we feel that causing people to think about how career and technical education can be broadened, expanded, supported is certainly an outcome of this work. There are those who are anxiously waiting. Good news. news is coming from the federal government. Even though we won't have enough money, there is a new grant coming from the federal government for local education agencies, 40 to 50 grants. And so some of these folks will be well positioned to apply for those should they so choose. So it was just announced this week, and I have the information I can share with you. So that's kind of the basics. We felt that there was not surprising in the distribution across the career areas. Certainly industry and engineering is one that would come forward with STEM as well. And, you know, we felt that it was just a good balance overall. We are meeting on Friday with the advisory committee, and I want to assure you that the staff and this committee are working with the highest integrity. A competitive grant process is a challenging process because you don't have enough money actually to give everybody an award. So there are always questions, always concerns about that. We're looking, we've done the preliminary runs on the numbers. Right now we're going through a validation process. You know, how did the reader score? Was there some level of consistency? And the committee will decide on Friday. I will just mention that we have made a commitment to a geographic distribution across the state so that rural areas are definitely included. So with that, I'll leave you for any questions. If not, again, thank you for your support.
Okay, thank you both for the presentations. I know that this is an interest of interest to almost every one of us. I'm sure looking at the map here, that each and every one of us have in our districts some of the groups that have applied for these funds. I know that at least one has come from Rep. Huffman's district in the school district of Sisters, where I get to spend some time, and I was involved in conversations with folks over there. A couple of questions I have, if I may. You mentioned the limited opportunities, Laura. You mentioned the limited opportunities for some of the rural areas. And I wonder if any of the applications that came in are looking to improve upon the infrastructure that would help those areas share in and participate in remotely some of the areas that we're trying to go in that they're proposing here.
I can't answer that in detail, but I believe that is the correct statement. There were several applications that were across regional, large regional areas. And so in those cases, you do have some remote connections. And we've also had experience in the previous grant where business and industry from Portland has, mentored students in Southern Oregon. So that possibility is there. And one of the things that our staff really would like to do is to be able to follow these grants and provide some technical assistance and also support those that did not get the awards in looking at what they can do as a next step. So I think that will be part of it. I can't cite the facts right now. There's 62 of them. We're summarizing them right now. So, but I believe that will be there.
Chair Harker, members of the committee, I can echo the comments that Laura had and is one of the reviewers in the four grants, and all of us were looking at four grants. I had a couple of different ones that fit those what you were talking about and questioning here. And I can say definitely there's a lot of creativity out there about how to string things together and work with other peoples out there. I mean, the thing is we've had declining resources for a long time, and then with the economy the way it's been for the last 5 years, I think that the blinders are off about partnering out there. Things that we didn't use to cross certain boundaries or jurisdictions and everything, everybody's being more creative about that now and saying we can't go it alone. I saw one from out in in a very rural area, and it was an interesting grant because they really right-sized the grant for their community and area, recognized the fact that they really had no significant industry to pull off of as partner, and yet did something that would be useful for the whole area, and then had a regional approach back to a community college quite a ways away to be part of their partnering so the kids had pathways on it. Thought it was just a marvelous grant for that fit its situation on that. And the big the sad thing is going to be we had 62 applications, and I think we'd like to probably, you know, fund all 62 of them out there. We did put a cap on the grants of a maximum of about $500,000 that you could ask for, and with an adjustment situation in that if you were asking for more than a quarter of a million in your grant, that you might need to be flexible when we're trying to match everything up at the end on that. And I think that $21.6 million actually would have been a lot higher than that if we'd have had higher grant levels on that. I think that there is an awful lot of great ideas that people maybe even throttled back on a little bit.
Okay, thank you. My last comment is, if you could, Laura, you mentioned the new federal money that has just been announced. I was personally not aware of that. If you could get the info to Victoria, and it could be made available to all of us.
I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Other questions, comments? Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nothing from your district along these lines, is there?
We're doing very well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
There was an application, Chair Harker.
There is one. That's our little pin on the map. We see the info about the request, but what's the pot that you have to distribute? I forget how much money we gave you to play with.
It'll be about 8.8, I believe.
Million, okay. Mm-hmm. As you review the applications, what are you looking for to ensure that these investments are going to lead to sustainable outcomes rather than just simply maybe a flash and, you know, a short-term blip, but then, you know, we're back where we were previously? What are you looking for in those applications?
Well, we did have them address sustainability in their application to the best as they, you know, as they can. But we're looking for how are they using those funds? Do they actually have partnerships that appear to be viable and ongoing? We're looking for what already exists. Are they leveraging what they already have? Or are they starting from scratch? So they were the kinds of things, and you know, that we're looking at. And I think we need to do need to follow up on that. I have to say, though, and I, you know, when you look at innovation and you look at what happens with innovation, it's important to realize that when you innovate, you're not always successful. And so, you know, when you, as Brian says, as you tighten up the RFP and put parameters around it, you're trying to support that success. But as you create innovation has a lot of things that go with it. And so we have to accept that fact that some people will go to the edge, do the very best they can, but the reality is sometimes what they put on paper, we don't always know internally what's going to make that be successful locally. And then the dynamic change in environment. You know, if a business moves out of a community, the local school districts have no control over that. So I think we have to accept that as a possibility, but at the same time, we have built it into the grant. We've asked the questions, and we will follow up as we make those awards.
Thank you.
I hope that you can have confidence in that, and we have confidence in them.
Okay, good. Rep. Gallegos?
Yeah, I just have a little question. Looking at the pins on your map, I'm just concerned that I don't see any pin down in Klamath Falls, and it's such an area of need down there. So I'm just wondering, how did you do your outreach? How did you do your promotion?
Well, I can assure you that Klamath Falls knew about the grants. Mm-hmm. We do our outreach through our superintendent's listserv. We do it through our CTE regional coordinators. I know that Southern Oregon in that area is undertaking a major effort to establish CTE in that community.
Okay. Okay.
My suspicion is that, and I don't know this for a fact, that they weren't quite ready.
Okay.
We had, I was telling Brian, we had 20 letters of intent from rural areas. Only 12 of them delivered on the grant. And the reason for that is some of them, as they got into it, found they weren't quite ready.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, last year, or the last cycle, we found people telling us, even though we didn't get the grant, it brought us together, and it started the momentum of the discussion around CTE.
Yeah.
So I do know that Southern Oregon is doing some serious looking at, in fact, I talked to the superintendent down there, some kind of reorganizing their school system around CTE. So my suspicion is that they were not ready, but I don't know that for a fact.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. If there are no other questions or comments, I'll thank you very much for the presentation and for the work, and good luck making those decisions.
Thank you.
It's okay. Always a challenge being on those review panels, and
it'll be heartbreaking.
It is. It is heartbreaking because there's always more good than you can fund, more good science, more good art, more good proposals like this. So, but thank you very much. Okay, we'll close that informational hearing on CTE revitalization and open an informational hearing on the PSU degree guarantee. Presenting to us, I believe, is Sana Andrews.
They are. And they don't always admit it.
They don't always acknowledge you.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Sana Andrews, and I'm the Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at Portland State University. And I'm very, very pleased to come and talk to you about the four-year graduation guarantee that we just announced a few weeks ago at Portland State. I'd like to tell you just a little bit about it, and then I want to show you a quick video that we have available on our website that we hope explains very briefly to parents and students what this guarantee is about, and then I'll go a little bit deeper into it and talk about how it relates to many of the other things that Portland State is doing in order to ensure that our students are successful and graduate on time. So the four-year graduation guarantee is actually Portland State's commitment to students and saying that we as a university want to make sure that we are not the reason that a student does not graduate in 4 years. We recognize that for many of our students, there are other factors that might impede their graduation, whether it be work or family or other circumstances. But we want to take ourselves out of the equation to be the reason someone would not complete. So the four-year graduation guarantee is our commitment to students that says, if you start as a freshman at Portland State University and you sign up for this four-year guarantee, we will make sure that the courses are available for you such that you can graduate in 4 years. And if they're not, then the courses required for your degree that were not available to you will be tuition-free to you. So I want to show you just a quick video and then talk a little bit more in detail about it and then respond to questions that you have.
College costs at public universities have increased. Public universities have increased by nearly 40% each decade as states have cut funding for higher education. That means more students are racking up debt to pay for college. Across Oregon, students who take out loans graduate with an average debt of $24,000. In fact, most students now take more than 4 years to earn a four-year degree because they cannot get the courses they need to graduate on time. That's changing at Portland State University. PSU's new four-year degree guarantee not only will save you thousands in college costs, but ensures that you get the support and courses necessary to graduate in 4 years. Here's how it works. You can sign a four-year graduation agreement if you are a full-time freshman entering PSU next fall. Under the agreement, you choose an academic major and work with an advisor to select the required courses. Then, as a full-time student earning 45 credits a year, you must maintain good academic standing and meet requirements for your major to stay on track. We will provide the academic advising and secure you a spot in your required courses each year. If you meet all the four-year requirements but still cannot graduate in 4 years, we won't charge you tuition for any courses needed to complete your degree. You pay for only 4 years. That's our guarantee. Portland State is the only public university in Oregon to offer a four-year degree guarantee. To sign up and get more details, go to pdx.edu/4.
So I think you have before you an information sheet about our four-year graduation guarantee. And I think the thing that's there's a number of things about it that are pretty exciting. First of all, every one of our 99 majors, every single one of our undergraduate degrees at Portland State is eligible to students under this four-year graduation guarantee. And that's a real credit, I think, to our faculty in terms of having them look at the offerings of courses and making sure that those courses are offered in such a way that they don't conflict with one another. So sometimes students might find that there are two required courses that are offered at the same time, maybe offered only once a year. So this insurance that those courses will be available that seats will be available for students so that there's not a reason why they can't get into a class. But the fact that then we are providing them with this intentional advising where they meet with an advisor, it just forms some great, great habits for students in order to be able to really look at their entire career as a student and map out how that looks for them. So I think it's really a great way for a student to be able to come into the university, get a sense of what they want to do, map out what those 4 years look like, and then be able to proceed along that path. One of the things that's made it possible for us to do this is that we've created what are called degree maps for every single one of our majors. And if you go on the Portland State website, if any student goes on the Portland State website and they look up our academic degrees, and we're showing this on the screen right now, they can, for every single degree, click on a degree map. So Debbie's going to click on a degree map for anything.
Computer science.
So what this does is it allows a student to take a look at a computer science degree and this map that allows them to see, here's what you need to be taking your first year, your second year, your third year, and your fourth year in order to complete your degree. Very, very helpful tool for students. Very simple tool. This isn't a complicated tool, but the fact that we're able to put these together for each one of our degree programs really allows a student to come in and know what they need to take. We'll show you one more. I'll let Debbie just pick. World languages. Okay, that looks good. So the degree map for world languages again shows what you would take your first year, what you would take your second year, and so on. And what the four-year graduation guarantee does on top of these degree maps, which, by the way, are available to all our students, what the four-year graduation guarantee does is say to a student, we will make sure that these courses are available in the right sequence for you, again, with the availability. Now, one of the questions that we get about the four-year graduation guarantee from students in particular is, well, what happens if I sign up and then I, as a student, no longer want to be in the guarantee? Well, there's no penalty for students. For a student, they can stop and drop out of the guarantee at any point that they would like. What's happened, though, in institutions around the country, other institutions that have this four-year guarantee, is that even students who start in the four-year guarantee program and then drop out of it for some reason, let's say maybe they can't take a full load that particular term or they have to stop out, those students tend to graduate at a higher rate and a faster rate than students who didn't originally sign up. And the reason is, it's like most things, and that is they've developed the discipline and they know the tools that are needed in order to be successful in getting through. So this four-year graduation guarantee is just one of the, what I call, tools that PSU has in order to help students with completion. And it benefits all of our students because we needed to create these degree maps in order to be able to offer this. That, I think, along with the other things that we're doing in terms of community college transfer, co-admissions, we just reaffirmed our agreement with Clackamas Community College just the other day, earlier this week, on the co-admissions policies that we have with community colleges, the accepting of dual credit, IB credit, those kinds of things which help students move along. We're just now moving into the area of credit and credentialing for prior learning experience. These are all kinds of things that are really designed to help students complete their degree in a timely fashion, which does obviously a number of things. One, reduce the cost to students, reduce the cost to the state, and produce graduates at a higher rate for us. So with that, I think what I will do is stop and respond to any questions that you have.
I'm going to start with a quick one, and then I think you're third in line at this point, but thank you.
Letting you know I'm interested, all right, in being part of this discussion.
All right, well, you started out this meeting saying you were going to harass me mercilessly, so I'm ready here.
You haven't seen it start yet.
Oh, I know. I thought that might be the beginning. Anyway, thank you so much for the presentation and for making this move here in our state, which I sincerely hope will help folks. This question is in no way intended as a criticism. It's a question that that has been thrown at me when I've spoken in positive terms about the program. And it's basically, what percentage of kids coming in know what their major is? I have two kids who went through. One changed three times. The other one, fortunately, didn't have to declare until after the sophomore year, which is a common situation. So, comments on that?
So, Chair Harker and members of the committee, it is oftentimes the case that students enter the university not knowing exactly what their major is, but they generally have a sense. So maybe they're not sure, gee, do I want to be a sociology or an anthropology major? You typically don't have a student enter the university that says, do I want to be a music major or a biology major? So the beauty of the four-year graduation guarantee is that it does allow students to change their major, that in most cases for students it would be just a slight shift. The kinds of courses that they would be taking anyway would be ones that would work toward a multiple numbers of majors. So this works well for the undecided student. It helps them make a decision early on. And I think one of the problems that we do face is oftentimes when students come into a university undecided, they can flounder for quite some time as an undecided major. Mm-hmm. This gets them committed to a major with an understanding that they can make a change in that major, but sets them on the right track. And again, usually it's within the, you know, a science student, you know, gee, I'm not sure, chemistry, biology, physics. But if they started out as a biology major, it's really quite easy to then shift to a chemistry major, so it does allow that. The other thing that I didn't mention that your comment made me think about is students have asked about, well, what about study abroad and internships and all those really important activities that are part of a student's learning experience? The four-year graduation guarantee has room for those things. Those are the kinds of things we would expect our students to be doing. So those can be easily built into the four-year guarantee for a student.
Okay. Thank you very much. I did happen to know two of my good friends were deciding between music and biology, and physics and poetry.
Okay.
But anyway, it was Ann Arbor in the 70s. So, did you want to ask about this?
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, just a couple of questions, and first of all, just a comment. You know, when I first heard about this, I was very, very excited. And this is, as you suggested, part of a national conversation where people are trying to address the issue of students not taking longer and longer to graduate and ultimately not being successful, because the longer that it takes to graduate, the lower the chances are that students will actually graduate. So I think this is really great. I do think that it makes sense to partner with the community colleges. For Portland State, where half of your students almost are coming from community colleges, to perhaps have a two-year promise. You know, if they come in with a transfer degree that has been coordinated closely with your plan. I didn't see summer as part of the planning, you know, program. And actually, I think that's a good thing, because I think for a lot of students, summer could be used to help fill gaps if for whatever reason, for work reasons or whatever, they have to drop below the full load. They can perhaps recoup some of that in the summer. I don't know if that, you know, has been part of your thinking. And then finally, you know, I think a number of schools that have been addressing this problem have been very rigorous in controlling students' ability to drop courses, right? So students who are on this kind of track, before they can drop a course, they need to get clearance from a counselor or, you know, from an advisor, just so that they're fully cognizant of the effects of, you know, what that might mean, the sort of sequence down the road of postponements that could delay their work. So I'm wondering if Portland State is you know, going down that road.
So, Representative Dembrough, members of the committee, I'm glad you raised the question about summer, and for a couple of reasons. One, the four-year guarantee does not require a student to take courses in the summer. One of the nice things is if students do take courses in the summer, they can actually graduate in less than 4 years. So there's nothing that prevents a student from graduating early. And it does allow for the kind of flexibility that if a student were in the four-year graduation guarantee program, that they could use summer as well as an opportunity. In terms of the student being required to get permission to drop a course, we haven't gone that route. We've looked at a number of institutions around the country that have done the four-year guarantee. Some do require that students get permission before they drop a course. Others do not. We felt as though if the students get the right upfront advice and if they also get into the habit of consulting with an advisor, that they would do that before they drop. So we haven't put some restrictions on that.
Okay. Representative Putnam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Comment, question. The comment is, thank you, and I was excited to hear about this, number one, because one of the drums that I've been beating for the last couple of years pretty strongly is in the advising arena, and to me this says that you're putting a strong emphasis or a stronger emphasis on advising up front so that, because we've heard testimony numerous times before this committee that students have been told that they needed to take courses that they found out down the road that they really didn't need to take for their major. And it's costly, it's frustrating, it adds to student debt. And so proper advising up front, I think, is a key, and I applaud you for heading down that road. On the Representative Dembrough brought up the two-year guarantee, and I kind of missed it in your presentation because I was sitting here wondering. I'm on the Accelerated Learning Task Force, and so we're looking at AP and IB and dual credits and dual enrollments and trying to encourage more and more students, if at all possible, to graduate and get a diploma and an AA degree at the same time. So on an Oregon transfer, and they come to you, do they sit down then entering as a junior, then picking their major, and they get a two-year guarantee? Is that what I hear?
Representative Huffman and members of the committee, thank you for reminding me. I didn't quite answer everything that Representative Dembrough had asked in terms of transfer students. First of all, the guarantee right now is just for freshmen. We thought we would launch it that way, but our intent is to make this guarantee possible for our transfer students, since many of our students are transfer students. The whole notion of a student connecting with an advisor is the real critical piece in all of this, and that's one of the things that the guarantee gets students to do. These degree maps are being designed in such a way that will also work very well for transfer students, that helps transfer students look at what they're coming into PSU having already taken, and then what they need to take. So our intent is that every student at Portland State have the opportunity to have the kind of advising that they need.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has been answered, but let me just make briefly a comment on the issue of if not requiring approval by a counselor, at least requiring that they check in with a counselor before they drop a class. I think that's really the important issue.
Agreed.
Thank you for asking such a good question.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and I too was excited to see this program come up, over the wires, if you were. But my question would be, I'm sure you had some interesting conversations with some department heads along the way. Could you just share a little bit about that, and in brief, I'm sure you could go on for quite some time, but some of the obstacles that you had to overcome in conversations with them to get them to say, yes, we can make this work.
Representative Johnson, members of the committee, the reason I'm smiling is that one would have thought that there would have been a number of obstacles. I was totally amazed at the incredible enthusiasm that our faculty and our department chairs showed about this. The fact that all 99 of our majors agreed to do this is pretty significant. What the exciting thing about it for faculty is that it created conversations at the department level as to why wouldn't a student be able to graduate in 4 years. And in fact, many of our departments thought, of course a student can graduate in 4 years, until they began to look at their curriculum and realized, gee, I'm offering a required course at the same time you're offering a required course. Or even things that are very interesting in terms of looking at the overlap of content in courses and recognizing that we might be able to streamline the curriculum. So what it did at the department level, which was just really wonderful, is it got faculty not only talking about what we offer, but when we offer it and how we offer it. And the fact that we didn't have a single department that said, we can't do this, I think is pretty impressive. And again, as I mentioned in my opening comments, I think speak incredibly highly of the faculty at Portland State. I've been a provost at another institution where we actually did a four-year graduation guarantee, and we got all of the majors to do it, but it was over a long period of time, and at Portland State, they all just raised their hand and said, we're in, we'll figure this out, and they did.
And one quick follow-up then. With that in mind, would you, in your humble opinion, is this something that could be replicated at other universities in Oregon?
and colleges.
Representative Johnson and members of the committee. Well, I'm the eternal optimist, right. And I would like to think very much so. I think that it's, again, the way we as institutions can make a commitment to our students that we will not be a reason that they do not graduate in 4 years. I think it requires faculty that are willing to look at the curriculum. I think it requires faculty that are willing to make some sacrifices and changes in maybe the times and the capacity of their courses and how many times a particular course is offered. But I think it's very possible.
Good. There's a will, there's a way.
Rep Gilliam, you're here.
Rep Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because I have a lot of questions and to save time, Provost Andrews, do you have a white paper that helped you make this decision that we, or an executive summary that we could have that Portland State, did you produce something? Because I'm interested in other universities, how they did it, how long they've done it, what's just their success record. Following up with my colleague, Representative Johnson, on the mapping process and how did you look at reducing course requirements and providing more alternatives so that 4 years can be met? So do you have anything in more detail that you could provide this committee? Most of the members of this, I think all the committee members of this committee, we supported a bill that asked the HEC to look at ways to save tuition cost and to graduate in 4 years. And so we'll have Mr. Nesbitt and Mr. Cannon later. I'm sure that we'll ask them to be sure that your program is included in that review. So.
Representative Wisson and members of the committee, we did some very detailed analysis that we can provide to you of other institutions around the country that actually have a four-year graduation guarantee in terms of the number of students that participate and how their guarantee actually works. So we looked across the country at what others were doing. And again, I had been at a university. In fact, I'd been at two universities that had done this, so I had some experience myself. In terms of the degree mapping, we have a lot of information on how we worked with departments in order to produce these degree maps and the requirements that departments had in producing the degree maps. We don't have a white paper per se, but we have a lot of procedural documents that help departments actually figure out how to do this and think about it and structure the conversations that they had around how to do this work.
I think what I would ask them, Provost, is maybe I'll send you a letter and ask you, and if you can respond to those questions, if you have anything. I don't want to put work on you, and I don't want the details.
You don't want the details. Okay.
Rep. Gallegos, and then we'll move to the next subject, which is near and dear to your heart as well.
Okay. Provost Andrews, thank you for being here. It's nice to see you here. I had actually wrote down three questions, but I think they're all related, maybe somewhat, to Representative Wisnitz. I mean, it took me almost, I think, about 10 years to get through undergraduate school. So I don't know where this program was when I was. But
you can come back.
Yeah, right. Thank you. My question has to do with a business plan. I mean, this seems very generous. One, in terms of free tuition, that sounds pretty generous. But I was also thinking about the actual advising time that goes into this as well. It seems like that's a bit more intense. So are faculty doing the advising? So is that faculty time that's being put into this, or do you have special advisors with this kind of program? And like I said, I had three questions that I think sort of fit in with this. It also seems like it's very student-driven. So in other words, a student is responsible for their following their map. And if they, I mean, and so students come in various kinds of levels of responsibility, I think. So what happens in terms of this, I was looking at the dropout counseling out of students who maybe are not following their map as well as they should be. So I don't know, those are different questions, hopefully wrapped up into something that you could respond to.
Representative Glagolis and members of the committee, I think they're all wrapped up around this notion of advising and around the idea that it's almost like preventative medicine. The more time we spend upfront with students in the advising of how to work and get through their program, actually, the less time we will spend dealing with individual student issues that come up. So we, in fact, see this as an opportunity for our advisors to spend more time with students around those particular issues that might come up throughout their program. So what we're doing up front is saying, spending the time with students, helping them work through how they would get through their degree program, and saving, actually, time of faculty and advisors, and also saving time for students. So from an economic perspective, it's a much better deployment of our resources at the university to do this preventative care up front, as opposed to having to deal with some of the very, very intricate, detailed issues that come up if there hadn't been this upfront advising. Yeah. We don't anticipate that there will be many students who are not able to complete the four-year graduation guarantee in such a way that we would then need to provide them with courses that are tuition-free. It might happen. It could happen. Mm-hmm. But our goal has been to make sure that we develop these degree maps and these course offerings in such a way that won't happen. But I just think the upfront advising is really, really beneficial. Mm-hmm. And again, it allows advisors much more time to deal with individual students later on in their program. So did that
roll all your questions
into one?
Thank you.
All right. Very good. With that, Provost Andrews, thank you very much. We will close the informational hearing on the PSU degree guarantee and open the next one, which is an informational hearing on future connections. Representative Gallegos, Whitney Grubbs, and John Wyckoff, help us out, please.
Instead of Wyckoff.
I see that we have a replacement for John Wyckoff. So introduce yourselves, please.
Hello, I'm Representative Joe Gallegos, House District 30, and I do want to point out that we have a very esteemed representation from House District 30 here today, and you'll be hearing from some of them. So, Chair Harker and ex-Chair Dembro and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we'll be hearing from a number of supporters after I get through very briefly talking. Are you laughing already? No. Okay. So, a little background. 2013, legislation was brought forward by the governor that provided over $70 million in strategic investments in education programs from pre-K, STEM education, dual credit, K-12 mentoring. However, at the end of the session, I requested $2.5 million for aspirations to college programs for competitive grants through community college and workforce development was not funded. So I'm hoping to bring this back as a pilot project for the remainder of the 13-15 biennium. I'll be requesting $1.5 billion. No, not billion. That's an M, I'm sorry. $1.5 million aimed at our community colleges targeting programs that provide access and success to our first generation and low-income students. The goal is to leverage our state investment by partnering our local business community, the philanthropic community, which I love, and our local governments to provide low-income students a chance to not only go to college, but to meet the promise of the 40, 40, 20, and thrive. I want to leave you with this one thought. If we're going to meet the promise of the 40, 40, 20, we need to think about how we're providing critical services to a new generation of students. In an increasingly global world, it's an economic imperative that the next generation of Oregonians has access to college and to the workforce training skills to help our communities thrive. So with that, I'm sure we'll have other comments and testimony, and I will come back up there. Thank you.
Good.
Unless you have questions right now. No, no questions. All right.
Come back to us.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Harker, members of the committee. I'm Whitney Grubbs. I'm the Chief of Staff for the Oregon Education Investment Board, and I'm here today to provide just a bit of context around House Bill 3232 and the strategic investment package that the governor and the Oregon Education Investment Board advocated for during the 13th session. As the Representative Gallegos mentioned, a piece of that strategic investment package was around guidance and support for post-secondary aspirations. And really, as we looked at across the P20 continuum, we were focusing on each of the core outcomes that we think are important to move the needle to get us to reach 40-40-20 by 2025. And one of the critical outcomes is really ensuring that as our demographic is changing, we've got a representative number of students of color, English language learners, students in poverty, first-generation college goers, all able to access and enroll and successfully complete some level of post-secondary degree. So after looking at a lot of research from across the nation, looking at programs in Oregon and where success was being found, we focused on the idea that students and their families deserve the opportunity to understand their pathway to college. There's some really incredible data and research out of John Hopkins and also out of EPIC at University of Oregon around one of the leading indicators that predicts a student's success in college is whether or not in middle school he or she thinks they're going to go to college. And so the idea of building on this college-going culture and really showing students and families that there is a pathway for them to be able to succeed is a very worthy investment. As the representative described, the governor and the OEIB really advocated heavily for all of the investments across the P20 continuum that were contained in 3232. At no point did we sever any of our children. We maintained the entire time that these were all critical priorities to really setting our state on a course to success. And this is the only priority that ended up being zero funded. So I'm here today just to express our continued support for the idea that this investment is one for which we would see some immediate outcomes. It is an effective and efficient strategy for improving the rates of enrollment and success for our underserved students. Thank you.
Okay. Not John Wyckoff.
Not John Wyckoff. So, Chair Harker, member of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And John is in another committee right now, so I'm subbing in for him.
Great. Welcome.
Just wanted to come today and indicate our support from the Oregon Community College Association for this issue. Really getting our underserved students into community colleges is really a core thing that we need to do as community colleges. And as we look at all the different leverage points for how do we best invest money to help us reach the 40-40-20? And we think this is really one of the critical ones. The data out there really shows that we're losing students that graduate from high school and don't come into post-secondary education. And we have students that still believe that college isn't for them. And so programs that can help us outreach and partner to let students know that there's multiple pathways once you get to college. College isn't just four-year degrees. There's certificate programs. There's two-year degrees at community colleges. There's multiple paths that they can move into a family wage job. And reaching out to them early, high school, ideally middle school, to let them know about the opportunities, if we feel comfortable with it and see this as a viable choice, really is a key to moving forward. We know from the data that we're just not doing a good enough job with those students. And to be successful in the 40-40-20, particularly that middle 40, we need to get them into the post-secondary education system.
Can you speak up just a little?
Oh, certainly. Sorry about that. So really the critical piece is to get them into the post-secondary education system. And this is a critical piece to help us do that. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whitney and Rob and John and several were at the Accelerated Learning Task Force meeting last week in Portland at Franklin. And, you know, again, one of the things that I've been talking about is advising at every level. And I think key to this approach is going to be advising, particularly at those younger ages, like you say, driving it down into middle school and throughout high school to let kids know what their options are and try to give them a glimpse of a vision or a dream that they could kind of sink their teeth into at some point whenever they're ready, psychologically and physiologically and every other way. How are we going to do that? How are we going to push money into advising so that we have the key people at the right places at the right time to do that?
I don't know.
I think we know what needs to be done. How do we get there? Are you talking about that?
Chair Harker, Representative Huffman, I think that's a critical question, and one of the theories behind the strategic investments is that while they're very small, and obviously relative to the $8 billion that we invest in education, this is a small amount of money, but our hope is that if we're able to do some targeted demonstrations of how these kind of best practices really do make a difference and how we are able to much more quickly move the needle, that we're going to be able to advocate to this body and the state of Oregon that this kind of investment needs to become the norm and that there are key strategies that we know are essential. And one of them really is ensuring that students and their families understand the pathway to college and really feel like they're part of this 40-40-20 vision. So I think you're right, and our hope is that when we come back before the legislature in 2015, we'll be able to have some evidence and map out for this body really how these kind of investments can move the needle across the state in the direction that we want it to go.
Okay, very good. We have two more panels on this same subject, so quick one, or you want to hold on to it?
No, I go for it right now. Whitney, regarding the OEIB and the achievement compacts and the strategic initiatives and investing about in ninth grade readiness, you know, making sure you're on track at ninth grade is obviously a key transition point and part of the strategic initiative about making sure that happens. But I think there are also tracks for us to run on, and I'm referring to the Eastern Promise and what they're doing out there in that they take it beyond that down to the middle school level. And for each student, you're charting an academic pathway to completion of high school, not just get you a diploma, but it's going to get you a significant amount of proficiency-based credits as well that you put in your little toolbox as you go to the next level, whether it's community college or university, and you've got a head start, but it gets you focused on that early. But I would say, too, though, in regards to our underserved population, specifically like the Hispanic community, I found that the reception in our local area to the Gorge Scholars Program, the Columbia Gorge Community College is putting on, which is free tuition for any high school student who graduates with a 3.5 GPA or better for the duration of their associate's degree. I had a Hispanic town hall in Hood River last Thursday night, and in talking with parents about that and families about that, they were just amazed. And they said, you know, but recognizing that
And my words to them were, you need to be talking to your students about this. You all need to, as middle schoolers, okay, because emphasizing the importance of making good academic progress, why it's important for parents to show up to every teacher-parent conference and so forth along the way. But I think with a lot of focus, with some information, it doesn't necessarily require a huge investment, but there are programmatic things that can happen, too, just in raising the awareness. So I think there's some great stuff going on, so we'll continue to fan the flames, and hopefully we can invest as we're able to.
Thank you.
Good point. Okay, thanks. Good comments. Anything else? Okay, thank you both very much for being here, and let's call up the next two people, Deanna Palm and Aaron Carlson. Everybody warm enough?
It's about 1,000 degrees in here.
Thank you very much.
Please introduce yourselves and begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Chair Harker and members of the committee. I'm Deanna Palm, president of the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce and also PCC College Board member representing Zone 7, which covers Washington County, as well as the rural communities of Vernonia and Columbia County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today alongside Council President Aaron Carlson from the City of Hillsborough. Our state's economy and economic strength and vitality depends on educating and developing a talented pool of diverse and skilled workers connected to and engaged with our community. Future Connect, with its career counseling, academic advising, internships, and other career development opportunities, is a remarkable case study, really, for our region's economic development strategy. An investment from the state legislature into programs like this would allow the program to spread across the region and to other communities across Oregon. A little about the program. Modeled on national best practices, the Future Connect program first launched in 2011 in Multnomah County. With funding from the City of Portland matched by PCC and private funds raised by the PCC Foundation, the program has served high school students in Multnomah County who have identified as first generation to attend college or are low income. The program now serves more than 340 Multnomah County students representing 28 schools at a total cost of only $2,000 per year per student. Future Connect ensures that young people who may not be likely to attend a post-secondary institution will earn a certificate or a degree that will help them contribute to our community in even greater ways. Students receive a Future Connect scholarship to attend PCC that also provides 2 years of individual academic advising and personalized coaching, which contributes to a high success rate. How high, you might ask? Future Connect students in a solid academic standing are retained at rates 3 times higher than similar students who don't receive the specialized services that Future Connect offers. We've seen a 70% retention rate of Future Connect students from fall term to fall term, which is significantly higher, approximately 50 percentage points higher than programs that don't offer this type of intensive student services featured as part of the Future Connect program. Since its launch, more than $1.1 million in private funds have been raised for the first 4 cohorts of Future Connect in Multnomah County, and 3 cohorts, of students have been fully funded. Few investments in education deliver this type of return. And now, thanks to support from the cities of Hillsborough and Beaverton, we're able to create this kind of dynamic in Washington County. Last year, each city earmarked $100,000 in city funds to support the Washington County Future Connect program. Each city's grant will be matched with funds raised by PCC and the PCC Foundation to be put towards scholarships for the program. Additionally, the Meyer Memorial Trust also has recently agreed to match donations for Future Connect. Not every community across Oregon has the ability to leverage local investments at this scale. But with the assistance from the state legislature, this type of program could be scaled to provide college students across the state with opportunities to succeed. Thank you for the opportunity to celebrate the successes of the Future Connect program. Great.
And good morning, Chair Harker and representatives. I'm Erin Carlson, the City Council President in Hillsborough. And just on a side note, the temperature in this room this morning reminds me of my father used to call on Fred G. Meyer, and he did stand-up meetings with a in a room where he had control of buttons that increased the temperature to get you to move along. So it also had a loud ticking clock, which is similar to when you open the door and the sounds come in. But anyway, these are the things that I learned in life as opposed to... Hillsborough decided to invest in the Future Connect program through using some of our Enterprise Zone funds that are intended to enhance our economic development. And one of the best ways to do that is to grow our own, to invest in getting a solid education for people that live in our community to come and work at our jobs. And we have many local business partners that already invest significant amounts of dollars to PCC, including Columbia Industries, Solar World, Genentech, Intel, that have two-year associate programs that put students into fantastic jobs. So what better of a next step when we saw what was happening in Multnomah County than to step up ourselves and say we want this for Hillsborough students. So we got to have kids that live in our area that I was told by a career guidance counselor at one of our local high schools that the students that were selected for this never thought they'd be going to school, never thought that they would be going beyond high school, and now they are working to achieve at least a two-year degree, and that will help them and help our community significantly on down the road. And we feel that this could be a model. Matter of fact, when we went in like a bull in the china shop promoting and saying that, yes, Hillsborough was going to do this, we really pushed Beaverton to have them to step up, too. So I think you all know we have a pretty good friendly rivalry going on. But what better to be able to benefit the students in our community? And I wish that we could do more. And the applications for this were, there were a lot. And I imagine that there will be even more. But the successes that we're seeing, the participation in the program, it's invaluable. And I would really encourage the state to take that next step, and I think having a hearing on this is a great opening, and I hope that you will continue in your partnership to help us to broaden this out throughout the community. And as one of the things that Deanna mentioned is advising is a very big part of this, and it was one of the advisors in Multnomah County that really tipped the scales for us, and Dara will be speaking here in a moment, was if we're going to have the Future Connect program in Washington County, in Hillsborough, we want her to come. And as a great success story, she is a local high school graduate from our community, and we're glad to have her back. And that's that one-to-one contact is what is helping those students to connect in this program. So I love this program. I'm proud of it. And anytime that it comes up, we'll be here and ready to push for more from your help as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks to both of you for your work and for stepping up, Hillsborough.
Yeah, Hillsborough.
Yeah. So happy that Beaverton elected to do the same thing. Questions or comments right now in this panel? Outgoing Chair Dembrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say also how proud I am of Hillsborough and Beaverton for stepping up in this way and really for seeing higher education and the goal of closing the achievement gap as being something that is, you know, it's a communal issue. It's an issue for all of us. All too often we're seeing higher ed becoming considered just a personal benefit, you know, for the individual. But the benefits to Hillsborough and to Beaverton and to the state as a whole from moving these young people on this pathway to success, it's enormous. It's just a very, very smart investment, and I really applaud you for thinking in those terms. We're not going to be able to succeed if we can't have partnerships like this, and public, private, city, county, state. It's great.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Harker. And you have 60 minutes left to Representative Dembro before you're sworn in to the other side of the building. Congratulations.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Let's see. The next panel is Dara Cohn and Aurora Fulgencio. Come on up, please. I hope I pronounced those correctly. If not, correct me.
Hello, Chair, Co-Chair, and Representatives. Thank you so much for this honor. My name is Dara Cohn. I am a college success coach and also instructor for the Portland Community College. This program, I'm here to testify on the behalf of the program to advocate and also to state for the record that Future Connect is working. I've been with the program for 3 years. I started off in Southeast Portland, and now I currently serve the Washington County. I started 50 Hillsborough students. 50 of them are almost done with fall term and have registered for winter term. The greatest joy in this program is to see the excitement in the students, not only in their personal gain, but also what they're able to give back to the community. I get really emotional about speaking about a program like this because I was one of the students, first generation college student myself, wanting to succeed so badly, but I didn't know how to get there. And then when I got there, I wasn't sure of myself. And a lot of the students that I see at Portland Community College are first generation and or low income. I've met them in their high school year, spring term, so I've had the opportunity about 5 months to get to know them personally, build a relationship and a rapport, to understand their barriers, their personal goals, and their challenges, and really understand why they want to be successful, not just in college, but as a person. There's always a motivational story and a personal story that touches my heart, and I feel that because of that kind of relationship, that's why Future Connect is working. Our program is structured in a very close manner. We have three required courses, highly encouraged for students to take: college survival, today's career, and the following year, as they are transitioning and making progress, they are able to take transitional course to the university. So our goal is not just to have them complete and graduate with just a PCC, a degree or certificate. We encourage, and if I have 50 students, I push all 50 students to complete an associate's degree and to help them move forward to wherever their heart desires, whatever university. And a perfect example of that is a student that's sitting beside me. She is a community leader representing PCC with her heart and passion, and she is that example of a first-generation college student. Her name is Aurora, and I'd like her to speak to her story on that. Thank you, Chair and Co-Chair and Representatives.
Good morning, Chair, Co-Chair, and Representatives. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share my story today. As a first-generation, low-income Mexican college student, I am grateful to have been chosen as a Future Connect scholar. I am grateful to have been... my mother is a stay-at-home, and my father works in the agriculture field. I have two brothers, one of which is adopted and disabled.
Excuse me just for a minute.
Yes.
We have rules here, so you just need to please introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, yes. My name is Aurora Fulgencio. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
Although my family does not have a lot of material things, we have done our very best, and I promise to be a good citizen and pay forward your generosity. You have given me a program that supports my success and a coach that mentors and builds my confidence and skills. You have lightened my financial burden and allowed me to focus on the most important aspect of school, deep learning. Your generosity has inspired me to help others and give back to the community. My first term at Portland Community College has been both challenging yet exciting. It seems that academically I am off to a great start because I understand the value of education and I take my studying very seriously. My goal is to complete an associate's degree in psychology and then move on to Portland State University in order to complete my master's in social work. When I learn more about myself when I serve others, which is why I have chosen to be that type of person. And I just really want to thank you for making these type of programs like Future Connect. I want to thank each and every one of you sitting above. We will make you proud. I am honored to be here today on behalf of the Future Connect body. And personal note, I have applied for a lobbying trip to Washington, D.C. this spring. I have also applied for the internship here, and I currently work at the Women's Resource Center at Portland Community College. I know my direction now because of Future Connect and because of my college success coach, Ms. Dara. She's my mentor and my instructor. I have three important role models in my life: my mother, one of my high school teachers, Ms. Stewart, and, of course, my coach, Ms. Dara. Your generosity is very much appreciated and accepted with extreme honor. Thank you so much.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah. Not often we get that much praise, is it, colleagues? It's wonderful when we can step up and commit some state resources to be partnered with other resources and produce programs that are able to do such things. And thank you for your commitment and kind words.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good. Yes, Rep. Greenland.
I have a question for Ms. Fulgencio, please.
Yes.
When did you first think about going to college, and how did that get to you?
I did always dream about it, but, like, I never imagined, I had my view of going there, but it was the resources, like, I didn't have the money, so when my senior year came up, I started filling out my FAFSA, and then I had trouble, like, with the red flags and all of that stuff, and that was when I applied to for the Future Connect scholarship, and then I still didn't know much because I never had that role model to help me and guide me through all the process of going to college, and that was when my coach Dara stepped in. She helped me. She guided me through all the process, starting, I believe it was April. That was when she first started helping me through all the process, and she made it possible for me to go. Otherwise, I don't think I'd be in Portland Community College.
How did you hear about the scholarship?
It was through the career center at my high school. They informed me about it because I was applying for other scholarships, but it's hard. It's hard to get scholarships, and they said, oh, apply for Future Connect. It's for low-income students, and I applied for it, and I remember she was talking about all the benefits, and I was just like, okay, I'll apply. I don't think I'll get it, but I still applied, and I got it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to obviously thank you so much for your testimony. I don't know if you noticed how quiet the room got when you were speaking, but I think that's just an example of leadership, and I just wish you all the best of luck, and I'm sure you'll continue to make us all proud. I do want to recognize that there are a number of other students. Could the rest of the students stand up and just let us know who you are, please? Thank you very much, and the best of luck to all of you, and you're all going to make us proud. Thank you.
All right, very good. Thanks so much to both of you for coming.
Thank you, sir.
Thank
you. All right. With that, I will close the informational hearing on Future Connections, and we will open the next informational hearing, which is on the Athletic Department hiring. We have Ryan Hageman here, yes, and I think someone's accompanying you, yes? Yeah. It doesn't look like there's anyone else coming.
I'm going to pass out a document for the committee.
Okay,
very good. Opinion on House Bill 3118,
okay.
Become relevant in this discussion.
Very good. And Ryan, I think we have, is Sam Sachs here as well?
He's been here all along.
I saw him. He was in the back room.
Okay. Sam, if you're here or out in the hallway, come on in, please.
There we go.
There he is.
I'll have you both up here together, a little bit behind, and I want to make sure you both get your opportunity. So, go ahead, take it away.
Chair Harker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Hageman, and I am the general counsel to the Oregon University System. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts on ORS 352-382B. Since the statute's introduction in 2009, it has sparked much interest, both because of its laudable policy objectives on one hand, and whether or not the requirements of the statute place Oregon's public universities at legal risk on the other. For the committee's benefit, when the statute was introduced in 2009, I expressed significant concern about how the statute's provisions would impact OUS institutions. Before I share some legal points that might help, that might assist the committee and the Legislative Assembly on a path, I want to emphasize the OUS commitment to workforce diversity unequivocally. Specifically regarding head coaches and athletic directors, OUS athletic departments engage in robust and recruitment and outreach efforts to ensure applicant pools are diverse as possible. Athletic directors personally reach out to underrepresented populations and colleagues across the Pacific Northwest and nationally to encourage qualified assistant coaches and assistant athletic directors to apply for OUS vacancies. OUS athletic departments, when interfacing with their athletic associations and accrediting bodies, are required to explain efforts regarding underrepresented populations. It is an effort that is taken seriously, deliberately, and intentionally. With that, some comments on the legal approach to ORS 352-382B. The statute itself states that Oregon public universities must interview one or more qualified minority applicants when hiring a head coach or athletic director unless the public university was unable to identify a qualified minority applicant who was willing to interview for the position. It is an affirmative defense to the claim of a violation of this paragraph that the public university, in good faith, was unable to identify a qualified minority applicant who was willing to interview for the position. The terms of the statute are critical in navigating the waters of legal risk. Minority, for example, is defined as a person of Black, Hispanic, Asian, or Native American origin. Because the statute defines minority in racial or ethnic terms, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution are implicated. The statute also speaks in terms of what public universities must do in terms of applicants, not candidates or individuals or persons. The universe is focused on applicants. Another important term, qualified, is not defined by the statute, but in order to avoid legal risk of violating federal or constitutional provisions, OUS institutions read the term to comport with Title VII and the constitutional case law, which I will address briefly later in my testimony. As stated, because of the express reference to racial or ethnic groups, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act is implicated. Both Title VII and the Equal Protection Clause prohibit government employers like OUS from discriminating on the basis of race. Title VII does, however, permit employers to take affirmative efforts to diversify their workforce, although those efforts may themselves not violate Title VII. An employer may take recruitment strategies more likely to reach more racially diverse populations and applications. An employer may express the desire to achieve a racially diverse workforce in position announcements. An employer may emphasize as a qualification for the position experience with diverse or underrepresented populations. OUS institutions and athletic departments in particular engage in all of these efforts, as I described earlier. With the backdrop of ORS 352-382B, it is important to note there are limited and narrow circumstances that permit a public employer to consider race among factors in selecting an employee. The U.S. Supreme Court has considered a variety of affirmative efforts in the employment context and upheld very few. A scenario similar to the statute was found in Johnson versus Santa Clara County in 1987. In that case, two applicants, a male and a female, were comparably qualified for a position that was dominated by men. Under a scoring system, the male applicant scored slightly higher than the female, but the county hired the female under a previously adopted affirmative action plan. In upholding the county's action, stressing the notion that the applicants were comparably qualified, the court outlined the factors necessary in order to use a prohibited basis, such as race or sex, in employment decisions. They include, one, it must be pursuant to a previously adopted affirmative action plan, two, in response to identified areas of underrepresentation, otherwise known as a manifest imbalance, three, the employer uses goals, not quotas, to achieve the ends, four, the candidates were comparably qualified, five, the mechanism must be temporary and used only as long as necessary to achieve the goal, and six, the mechanism may not unnecessarily trammel the rights of others. This case animates my previous discussion on the lack of a specific definition of qualified. Because of the Johnson and other similar guidance, OUS must read qualified in the statute to mean comparably qualified. If applicants are comparably qualified and one applicant's race, among other factors, is considered, along with the other Johnson factors, legal risk against a Title VII or Equal Protection Clause claim is reduced, although not eliminated. If, on the other hand, OUS is required to read qualified to mean anyone minimally qualified for a position gets an interview solely or substantially because of the applicant's race, OUS, in my view, faces grave legal risk. As for the Johnson factors, I am unaware if the state did any analysis of whether or not there was a manifest imbalance reflecting an underrepresentation of the qualified workforce. If so, and there is a manifest imbalance, I am unaware if there was any consideration of neutral alternatives to remedy the imbalance, another required practice under Title VII case law. I am also unaware if it was determined neutral factors would not work, if there was any analysis of the plan or mechanism would not unnecessarily trammel the rights of others. At that point, under Johnson, temporary measures could, as long as they were not quotas or unnecessarily burdensome to other applicants, be put in place to consider race as one of several factors. I also think it is important to consider the court's evolution on race and employment after Johnson. In 2009, almost contemporaneous to this body's passage of the statute, the court decided Ricci versus DiStefano. In that case, New Haven, Connecticut had a process, including a test, which it used to consider promotions of its firefighters. When no African-American firefighters passed the test, the city threw out the test because it was afraid of a disparate impact claim. 17 white firefighters and one Hispanic firefighter sued when they were not promoted, arguing that New Haven, despite its concern about a disparate impact claim, impermissibly considered race in an employment action. The court agreed with the white and Hispanic firefighters. The court held that there was not a strong basis in evidence that it would face the disparate impact claim, and the disparate treatment of those white and Hispanic firefighters violated Title VII. A final observation with regard to navigating these legal waters is the extremely high standard that would be used if a constitutional challenge were lodged against OUS or the legislature for the operation of this statute. As an aside, under Personnel Administrator of Massachusetts versus Feeney in 1979, it is possible, because this is a statutory requirement, that the legislature and not OUS would be required to defend the action. While the requirements between Title VII and the Equal Protection Clause are similar, the court analyzes all classifications on race that implicate the Constitution under the strict scrutiny standard. Any use of race, including consideration by a public employer in an employment decision, must be one, narrowly tailored, and two, to achieve that a compelling state interest. Returning to the discussion of the terminology, because the definition of minority, if ORS 352.382b were challenged or we were sued, the strict scrutiny standard would apply. Thus, in addition to the Johnson factors required for a Title VII inquiry, OUS would also need to demonstrate that any use of race was compelling and narrowly tailored. The previous description of qualified pertains here. It is very likely that a court would strike down any scheme that allowed minimally qualified applicants to interview for jobs solely or substantially on the basis of their race. That simply would not be narrowly tailored. The manifest imbalance at comparably qualified factors of Title VII and the strict scrutiny requirements of the Equal Protection Clause are inescapable features of the terrain public universities face when, in good faith, they discharge their obligation to comply with ORS 352.382b. In organizing this presentation, soon-to-be Senator Dembro asked me to consider some possible amendments to the statute that would preserve the policy objective but smooth or mitigate legal risk at the same time. The legislature could require public universities to document good faith efforts to bring interested and qualified applicants into the pool. HR offices and athletic departments could review position qualifications to ensure they were necessary to fulfill the responsibilities of the position and not create a barrier to applicants to enter the pool. Public universities could propose action-oriented programs that should diversify the workforce. The legislature could also require periodic reports on progress that in turn could lead to fruitful conversations about the diversity of public university workforces. I want to share, pursuant to my previous conversations with Representative Dembro, I have started to work on a constellation of possible statutory amendments. If the committee is interested, I would be happy to transmit some suggestions after our internal stakeholders are afforded a chance to comment. Depending on the result of our conversation today, we plan to convene the athletic directors, HR directors, and OUS lawyers to continue the constructive dialogue with tangible suggestions for your consideration. At a fundamental level, OUS and its public universities are singularly committed to a diverse workforce and compliance. compliance with all the legal requirements we face. These requirements include not only ORS 352-382B, but Title VII and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The statute may be navigated by OUS, and make, as long as we can continue to rely on Johnson and similar cases, may continue to utilize a comparably qualified definition, and the affirmative defense remains in the statute. That said, there might be other avenues to revise the statute to accomplish the important policy objectives, including regulating courts, for example, on one hand, and change the landscape of legal concern at the same time, if the committee is interested. I know my lengthy legal lesson might have been much to digest, but I stand ready to answer any questions you might have.
Questions or comments at this point? Yes, Rep. Greenlee.
Can I ask a couple?
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you believe, as the legal advisor to the OUS, that it's the obligation of the state universities to follow the statutes of the state of Oregon?
Representative Parker, Representative Greenlee, of course. We take.
And has that been your position to them, that there's a statute, it's their obligation to follow it?
Chair Harker, Representative Greenlee, absolutely.
And do you believe that, have you asked the Attorney General for a formal opinion on the legality of the statute?
Representative Harker, Representative Greenlee, in 2009 when the statute was introduced and crossed my desk, I immediately reached out to the Attorney General for their assistance. It was later in the session. They did not issue a formal or written opinion.
Have you asked them to issue a formal or written opinion?
Not at this juncture, because we're no longer under the Department of Justice.
You're an independent counsel. You're not. Right. And I think one last question. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court opinions that you cited relate to the hiring or not hiring of an application. Is there any Supreme Court decisions that relate to who is available to apply for a position, whether or not they're hired?
Chair Harker, Representative Greenlee, I mean, it's a very important question. There are, not off the top of my head, there is a great body of Title VII and 14th Amendment case law that kind of talks about what we call employment actions. And so it's a public employer like OUS the decision about not using race is not confined to a hiring or a firing decision, but a whole panoply of employment actions. And it would be our view that choosing someone to interview for a position when they are not comparably qualified solely or substantially on the basis of race would violate Title VII or the Equal Protection Clause.
Is there a Supreme Court decision that says that?
Not directly, not to my knowledge.
And have you, one last thing, I've distributed to the committee our legal counsel's opinion that we used in designing this statute. Have you reviewed that?
Chair Harker, Representative Greenlee, no, I have not.
We'd be happy to make it available to you.
I would love to read it.
And I think I'd be interested in hearing some proposals for amendments. That seems to me something that we're always open to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Of course. Rep. Dimber?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian, thank you for all the work that you've done and all that you're going to do on this issue. So each of the universities, I assume, has an affirmative action policy, right? Or is there a single affirmative action policy for OUS? And actually, before you answer that, you know, I just want to say, as I ask that, I'm thinking back to the first panel that we heard from today, where we were discussing the need to find ways to bring more faculty of color into our universities. And that's a challenging thing. It's a challenging thing to do. And I know that, I assume that each of the universities has some sort of affirmative outreach, you know, kind of program that the HR directors follow. And I'm wondering, are there two systems, one for regular faculty and administrators, and then one for people in the athletic world?
Chair Harker, Representative Dembro, there's a lot there to unpack. I think that given the fact that we have 13,500 employees, all of different stripes, there are certain things that apply to any kind of search, whether it be an athletic employee or a faculty member. A lot of those, for example, are found in the board's administrative rules. So there's some high-level things that apply no matter what. each institution, though, is delegated quite a bit of authority over human resources. And so to answer your question, there are affirmative action plans. There are diversity action plans. A lot of elements of those are rolled up when we report to the state. And so we frequently will report our affirmative action plan as a collective to the state because that's how it's required. But it's very difficult to say that all searches are done the same way, because they're not. I think that just because of the wide variety of the types of employees that we have, there are going to be fundamental differences. There are, however, going to be fundamental similarities in how HR offices function, including but not limited to the collection of affirmative action data.
Okay. And if I could just follow up, we're in a transitional year now where several of our universities are forming their own boards, and each of those boards will have to, one of the first things they'll have to do is adopt a set of policies, for themselves. And a lot of that will be based on existing OUS policy, but I assume they'll come up with their own policy. And I would really encourage them to take advantage of that moment to kind of rethink some of these policies and come up with the proper policies that work for Portland State University, University of Oregon, Oregon State University, and any others that might form boards.
Thank you.
Good points. All right. Mr. Sachs.
Okay. Chair Harker, members of the committee, I'm going to take a kind of a different approach. First, I prepared a statement, but I also, do you have the...
Excuse me, could you just move the microphone a little bit further away from yourself?
Okay.
And introduce yourself for the record, if you would.
I'm Sam Sachs. Representative Greenlick gave you a handout today, and so I'm not qualified to argue law with Mr. Hageman, but I just wanted to read to you where it says, United States... The Supreme Court has concluded that race-conscious admission policies must be limited in time, since future legislative assemblies are not bound by actions of the 75th Legislative Assembly. The provisions of House Bill 3118 could be amended at any time, and thus the provisions could be considered limited in time. The court, however, has shown a strong preference for sunset provisions and periodic reviews. Therefore, House Bill 3118 would more than likely survive a constitutional challenge if the provisions of the bill had a definite sunset date, which this does. It goes on to say that House Bill 3118 most likely does not violate the 14th Amendment. So as we're here today, it's 3 years now since this became a law. I'm a little uncomfortable arguing whether this law should be a law, because it's been a law for 3 years, and this is the first I've heard of Mr. Hageman's concerns. I don't recall any testimony from him or anyone else to this nature during the whole process. So, my statement. First, I'd like to publicly thank Representative Greenlick for his support on this issue. And if not for his willingness to sponsor this bill, it would not have become a law. So I want to thank him for his support from the start and throughout. I'm here today to discuss House Bill 3118, affectionately known as the Rooney Rule. In 2009, the legislative body passed House Bill 3118, 53-4 in the House and 29-0 in the Senate. Oregon became the first and so far the only state in the country with a law that requires at least one qualified minority be interviewed for any head coaching and athletic director position that came open at our 7 state-funded colleges. Before it passed, the law was amended to include all head coaching and athletic director positions. I had originally brought the bill forward only for head coaches in football. The House saw the value in such a law and saw the evidence that showed we can do better when it comes to this area. The legislators wanted to make sure that this law included all sports. It was an exciting time and one that I was proud of as an Oregonian. Since its passage, at least 8 other states have attempted to pass similar legislation, but none have. And for those of you who don't know, the National Football League has this law in place, or this requirement in place. That's where it came from. I'm here today to say there's still work to be done. This year alone, 2 schools with three positions, have selected a new head coach or athletic director, and not one qualified minority was interviewed for those positions, a violation of the law. Western Oregon University has admitted to violating the rule in its search for an athletic director and for a head men's baseball coach. Oregon State has admitted to violating the rule in its search for a women's softball coach. Unfortunately, there is no penalty for these violations. When the law was passed, it did not have a penalty in place or a reporting and tracking system. I alone discovered these violations. Today, I'm here to ask for a review, an investigation, an inquiry, whatever you want to call it, into the progress of the Rooney Rule. And I want to refer back to the handout that Representative Greenlit gave you, where it does say in here that periodic reviews also could provide, could be provided formally through legislation or informally through the rules or other practices of the State Board of Higher Education. Currently, the Oregon University system, to my knowledge, does not have an employee who is tasked specifically with the responsibility of monitoring how these schools are following the Rooney Rule or what they can do better to meet the requirements. We've heard a lot today about diversity and equality, not just when we're talking, but the individuals that came before us. It's a little troubling to me as a citizen to learn that in 2008, 2009, the chief diversity position was eliminated. So, to my knowledge, the Oregon University system does not have a diversity officer or chief diversity officer or equity officer. I think that that is one area that we really need to focus on, and I hope you will focus on creating that position and bringing that position back, because I think from the testimony we've heard earlier and the testimony you're hearing today, we need that position. Who's keeping track of the Rooney Rule? Who's consulting with these schools on how to meet the requirements of the law? I find it difficult to believe that Western Oregon University could not and did not identify at least one qualified minority applicant willing to interview for the position of athletic director. There are literally hundreds of thousands of athletic director positions throughout this country and assistant athletic director positions. If schools are having a difficulty identifying qualified minority applicants to interview, I publicly offer my assistance. I'm asking this body today to initiate a review on the Rooney Rule and how it is working. Are there other violations? What needs to be fixed? How can we track and report each school's compliance? I also would like to see some amendments myself and additions to the law. It's my opinion that without a consequence, schools may continue to violate the law, so I believe at this point a penalty should be added. There should be a tracking and reporting system so each school and the public knows the Rooney Rule is being followed. The affirmative action speedy waivers need to be minimized, if not eliminated altogether. For those of you who don't know, a school can request a speedy waiver from its affirmative action office so they can speed up the hiring process of a coach. From my research, those speedy waivers are more the norm than they are an anomaly, I guess. So they happen more often than not, is what I'm saying. And I think that those need to either be eliminated or looked at more stringently and given out less. Assistant head coaches, in some cases, if not all, should be added to the law. Many of the assistant head coaching positions are the pipelines for head coach, as in the case of Western Oregon baseball head coach recently hired and the University of Oregon. So both positions, baseball at Western Oregon and the University of Oregon football coach, were both assistants with these schools. So perhaps also including assistant coaches in the requirement for minority interviewing could be an amendment. Lastly, and most importantly, I already touched on it, the Oregon University system, in my opinion, must create and hire a diversity chief to oversee our higher education system. It's hard to understand how this position does not already exist. Thank you for your time, and I have answered any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both. Questions, comments? Somehow I thought you might have one, Representative. Please.
It's not a question. It's not a comment. I should get it.
I will be looking into proposed changes in this rule and for the 2015 session. But I have resisted, and I continue to resist, the notion that there needs to be penalties for this. It's my belief that the state university system wants to follow the law, and that they have all sorts of statutes that they have to follow in their work, and that I think and I trust that they will. I was troubled, and I asked for this hearing because in messages we received from the Western Oregon University, I thought I heard them say that they had received legal advice that basically told them to ignore the law. And that troubled me a lot, because if they are getting advice to ignore the law, then I think we have a real problem. And I think the question is, what are we gonna do about the problem? If there's ambiguity in the statute, and I'd be delighted, I will ask for an attorney general's opinion on that to help guide me any attempted changes in 2015. We need to clear those up. But this passed overwhelmingly in the legislature, because how can it be a problem to try and change the applicant pool? This isn't about who the universities hire. It's simply about how they enrich the applicant pool to attempt to achieve objectives that all the universities have. And I want to continue to find a way to make that real. This has had effect. The Eastern University athletic director told us that by following the Rooney Rule and by trying to get new applicants, he ended up with a much better applicant pool and with better coaching hire decisions. The Portland State football coach testified to this committee several months ago that he was included in the hiring process because of the Rooney Rule, and he got the job because he had a chance to apply. I mean, when we asked the minority football coaches would they mind being involved in this if it was just a show, they said no, they'd be delighted, because they said we're athletes and we're competitors, and all we're asking for is a chance to compete. We'll get our share of wins. So I want to have a chance to continue to talk to you about this, and I expect there'll be individual counsel of the universities, but I think we all ought to be working together to try and make this work better, because I think we all agree that this is the sort of thing that ought to work, and I'll take the lead on that, and anybody wants to join in that with me, we'll work towards an improvement in 2015.
Okay, very good. And Mr. Hagerman,
just very
opportunity
briefly
to briefly respond to some
Chair
of this.
Chair Harker, Representative Greenlech, I am very encouraged by your desire to take this offline and have many conversations, and I will be the first one to have those conversations with you. For the record, I've represented this agency for 13 years, both from the Attorney General's office and in-house, and I have, Western or any of the other institutions, have never been advised to ignore or violate ORS 352-382B, never.
Very pleased to hear that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We will revisit this, I am sure. I'm going to now close the informational hearing on athletic department hiring and open the next informational hearing, which is on the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. Looks like we have Mr. Nesbitt and Mr. Cannon here with us.
We're burdened today with ex-House members, or soon-to-be ex-House members, but I think we'll be able
to. Are you going to be able to stay with us?
Probably for about 10 more minutes.
All right.
5 or 10. Right.
You don't want to be late for your coordination.
You ought to be there.
Yeah, I'll dress up. No place to go.
Take it away.
Good morning. Chair Harker, members of the committee, and Senator Dimbro. I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm the chair of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Way too soon.
And I'll be saying a few remarks to bring you up to date on our work and then turning it over to our executive director, Ben Cannon. Most of my colleagues are new to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We have two carryover members, and I wanted to start by recognizing the work that was done by our predecessors who worked on specific projects that this assembly gave them to work on. I'll then call your attention to the policy work that your assembly has given us to work on going forward, as well as directives that we're undertaking for the Oregon Education Investment Board. And then finally, I want to talk about our larger and longer-term purposes and how we expect to achieve the goals that you've set out in the legislation for us. Prior projects undertaken over the prior year included a study of Western Governors University, which came to you earlier this year, a study on textbook affordability, and a study which has led to an ongoing process now related to credit for prior learning. We feel that there remains a number of unfinished pieces of business and recommendations in all of those areas, and certainly the Credit for Prior Learning Committee is doing good work carrying that forward as well. You've given us the new task of designing a pilot project for the Pay It Forward concept, as well as looking at the merits of a tuition freeze. You've also given us something of a real-life test of that concept during the remainder of this biennium. We appreciate that. And also the Oregon Education Investment Board at their meeting in September asked us to take a deep dive into looking at the record of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program over the last 8 years or so since we designed the shared responsibility model. I happen to be one of the architects of that shared responsibility model, and I certainly agree it's time to take a look at it and how it's working given the level of funding. If we were fully funding the shared responsibility model for financial aid that we designed back then, 2005, it would be costing us $300 million a year because so many more students have been showing up at our colleges and universities. So many more are coming to us with lesser income and ability to pay and therefore greater financial need. And, of course, we've seen up until this year tuition continuing to rise, so costs have been rising as well. So it would cost $300 million to fully fund that program. Now, you're budgeting $50 million a year. So the question we have to look at seriously is whether the program as designed should continue to be triaged into a program one-sixth the size it was intended to be, or whether it needs to be redesigned. And also, how it was working all along. Because I think even if you had fully funded it, we would have said now's the time to take a good look at it and tell you how it's working in terms of not just access and affordability, but completion. So that's work that is being undertaken right now. But then there are the larger responsibilities. The system's changing, as you know. We'll soon have three boards that are major universities. You've given us a responsibility which is much more arm's length. We're not a governing board, we're a coordinating commission, and I've been summarizing our responsibilities with the concepts of steer and cheer. Steering the universities and community colleges, using the incentives of a funding formula and focusing on how the dollars flow so that we get the best results. Cheering means creating that culture of learning beyond high school. We used to call it a college-going culture. It's got to be a college-going and college-completion culture. And it's something that we have to communicate to our to all the students in our system, especially to high school students, so they see the importance of achieving higher levels of learning, both in high school and beyond. And, of course, access and affordability is a big part of that. Student success, therefore, becomes a priority in all of our work. And what Ben Cannon will share with you in a few moments is we have to look as well beyond at the outcomes. So you get your degree, then what? How does your degree match up to the opportunities in the economy and the needs of employers in the workforce? And here, looking at the data just in the last 2 weeks, and you'll see some of it in a moment, I've become convinced that cheering isn't enough. We need to guide students as well so they make informed decisions about their learning paths in our institutions. So with that, I'm happy to turn it over to our executive director, Ben Cannon.
Chair. Yeah, before Senator DeBeeson leaves, because he has to leave, I'm not sure how long Ben's presentation is going to take. Mr. Nesbitt, I'd like to talk briefly about the study you mentioned, because several members of this committee were involved in creation in that bill. And there's other things part of that bill that we want you to look at. And we had a great presentation this morning by PSU on the graduating 4 years. So those are things, this whole committee spent a lot of time last session looking for ways to not only freeze or hold back tuition. We looked at the Western Promise, the Eastern Promise, all those things. So the study we're looking for from the HEC is addressing anyways. And we're all, think the committee here speaking for them, I think we're impressed with the PSU things. So that's the things we're looking for you to help us look at ways to bring down tuition, which improves access. So it's not just to pay for it, play it back, which is an interesting concept that we'll ask you to look at and advise us on, please.
Yes, Chair Harker and Representative Wisnant, we have charged our work group, and we just met over the last 2 days and set up the appropriate work groups, to looking not only at designing a pay-forward model, but looking at other alternative ways to accomplish the same goals.
Mr. Chair, and because one of the things I think we put in there, even, you know, they're looking at $10,000 degrees, you know, a cheap one, or a Ford instead of a Cadillac degree or something like that. So any of those things is what we're looking at, so thank you.
Chair Harker and members of the commission. Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Really excited and honored to be coming to you for the first time in this new position, but certainly not the last, I'm sure. So just following on Tim's remarks, so the new commission, the reappointed commission, has met twice. It had mostly orientation activities at both its first meeting and then its second meeting over the last 2 days. As the chair mentioned, it has created work groups and subcommittees that will be taking on many of the topics that he mentioned. We're also in sort of agency startup mode. Obviously, my hiring was the beginning of that, and I'll be building a small staff to help support the commission in the exercise of its responsibilities, many of which come fully online July 1st of 2014. So that's all work that's underway from my point of view. I wanted to spend just a little bit more time on some of the work that's coming your way sooner rather than later. In particular, a study that you asked the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to do relative to common course numbering. So I'll touch on recommendations that the commission adopted and is forwarding to you for very soon. I think the deadline for that is December 1st, so you'll have that in your hands shortly. I won't spend a lot of time on that. If the chair and the commission choose to, you know, hear from the experts, it wouldn't be me, but the folks who really led that work. We're happy to bring that before you in February or at your whenever your next meeting takes place. And then I'll shift to some of the data that Tim described that I think I've just put in the category of provocative question raising, helping to shape sort of some of the way that we're thinking, perhaps not quite actionable yet, but still worth, I think, seeing. So on the common course numbering study, this work, and we have staff in the room who helped write the report that you will see. So I'm just going to run through really just a couple of slides on this. But common course numbering, the study was on a real short turnaround time. It was the bill was adopted in 2013. Our report, as I said, is due December 1st. But an advisory group was created. It was led by Connie Green, the president of Tillivick Bay Community College, and Joe Holliday, assistant vice chancellor of the Oregon University System. They met with others over several months. They spent a fair amount of time, and you'll see in the report, looking back at the various efforts that have been undertaken in the state to facilitate transfer among and between Oregon's public institutions of higher education. And they sort of concluded that we've done a lot in this state and there's still a lot more to do. Many of the expressions of good intent have not been met with associated levels of funding and support, but nevertheless, a lot of positive work has been done. Specifically, relative to common course numbering, they actually attempt to sort of shift the emphasis and say common course numbering is part of a larger set of work having to do with establishing common course outcomes or common learning outcomes, and that's really where the emphasis should be. Their recommendations were that the state, probably via the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, ensure that there are annual cross-sector faculty convenings by discipline to build on existing work in establishing common course equivalencies or common learning equivalencies across and between institutions. So a course is a course is a course. And that staff be dedicated to that convening of principally faculty in the effort. They had some sort of budget and investment recommendations, modest but resource, but would require likely at least a little bit of additional resource, certain amount of travel and technology. They established that there's not a need for any new Oregon revised statutes or administrative rules. Again, certainly you'll get the full report and be very happy to bring the experts back to delve into the subject more if you're interested. The other report, Tim mentioned it.
Yes, sorry, Representative. You said the who's on the committee, and you know, I think every member, several of the members of this committee, we've attended national governors and NCSL things about this course, you know, common course numbering. It's doing, it's happening. You know, you mentioned the lack of funding. It's also lack of really desire by the department heads and action. We need action to do this. And this, we keep talking about this every session. So are they people outside of the University of Oregon system that are giving their input, saying it can be done, and trying to fight this resistance, Ben? I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. so the as I mentioned, the committee was led by Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant. The committee was led by Connie Green, who's the president of Tilbrook Bay Community College, and Joe Holliday, who is in the Oregon University system in the Chancellor's office. Participants included a variety of folks principally from community colleges and universities. So I would share your belief that sort of external perspective on the value of alignment and simplicity, I think, when it comes to students being able to navigate what appears to be and is, in fact, a very complex system of higher education. I think that value is one that we, and certainly as the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which is mostly outsiders, if you will, non-employees of higher education, I think that's a value that we need to continue to bring forward. And I know the chair and other members of the commission have been thinking a lot about, for example, enhancing a web portal type of opportunity for students to access sort of the credits that they've achieved, align those with pathways to career among and between institutions.
Thank you for your
comments. Clearly a need. I won't say anything about the credit for prior learning report except to, I mean, I know, having been in your shoes, I know how many of these reports you tend to receive. Look out for this one. Credit for prior learning is a topic that the HEC is required annually to report to you on. There has been good progress made, and standards are being developed, and we expect ultimately those standards to be adopted by institutions around the state for recognizing credit for prior learning. So some important work there, not any that requires legislative action, to my knowledge, in February, but still a topic that the committee may want to return to. Finally, the data. So I'm going to switch gears here, and this is just some interesting data that has been developed by Echo Northwest and was presented to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission on Monday. And I'm going to refrain from editorializing very much about this, but just put it out and sort of say we think this is important and interesting. The first slide here compares the annual earnings for workers in Oregon with the average annual earnings for workers around the country by level of educational attainment. We know, you're well aware, I know, that Oregon workers on average earn less than workers nationally. That that cut, if you will, is significantly more for our college-educated workers, interestingly, although this also demonstrates what we all know to be true, which is that college degrees boost one's earning significantly, likelihood of earning significantly over those who do not have a college degree. Here, Oregon turns out to be 50th in the nation, and by a good measure on the percentage of our college-educated residents, working-age college-educated residents who are employed full-time, full-time defined here as greater than 35 hours per week and more than 40 weeks per year. that is, I think, clearly part of the explanation or contributes partly to the wage gap.
Ben, what's that number down there? What percentage?
For Oregon?
Oregon.
It looks to be about 63%. I don't know. I don't know exactly.
Plus or minus.
Wow. But it's significantly less than the national average at 71, and in fact, less than the other 49 states. This is where perhaps the slides have most policy relevance for the HEC. This establishes the concentration of degrees in Oregon relative to what one would expect given Oregon's size and population. And so a bar here of 1 to the 1 would be aligned with what one would expect given Oregon's size and population. So it attempts to show where we may have over higher than expected concentration of degrees. And these are adults with degrees and lower than expected concentration. I'm sorry that the fields on the left-hand side aren't shown in their entirety. You can begin to get a sense. It's perhaps not surprising that relative to Oregon's population and size, environment and natural resource degrees are overrepresented in this state. I think that's given our economy, that's not terribly surprising. But there, you go on down the list: theology, religion, interdisciplinary studies, area, ethnic, linguistics, architecture, and you can see on the bottom of the list: engineering, tech, computer and information technology, business, public affairs, criminal justice, lower than expected concentration. This slide is a result of migration patterns, right? People come here with degrees and they leave here with certain types of degrees. But the same data was also produced for concentration degrees produced by Oregon colleges and universities, and I believe this is both public and private universities. And you see same kind of tendency. Similar fields are overrepresented and others are underrepresented. And so at risk of editorializing, I think what this has said to me, or the questions that it's raised for me, and I think also for the chair, have been questions around 40-40-20, yes. We are committed to increasing levels of educational attainment in Oregon, and we believe that we know that will be that is important for Oregon's economy and Oregon's society in the future. But it feels insufficient, degree attainment alone. And so the conversation that we are beginning to have and look forward to really engaging you in is 40-40-20 for what? What degrees? And how do we help students at a minimum understand the consequences or the implications of their degree choice? And Tim alluded to a potential role for the state, certainly for institutions, to help to guide students, at least to bring forward the type of information that may affect how they make their decisions relative to degrees and their fields. So I'll leave it at that. We don't have a policy recommendation, but we are beginning to chew on it. And wanted to let you know that.
I'll just go right to your last area there without asking you to editorialize too much, but some have approached me and others about weighting some of these degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Has this been discussed yet?
So, Mr. Chair, one of the responsibilities of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is to determine how to allocate funding to institutions, and one of the ways in which we allocate state funding today through the Board of Higher Ed is to universities is on the basis of our expectations around the costs of various degrees and how many students will enroll. And I think that seems to me, to directly answer your question, that seems to me to be a very prime sort of opportunity for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to express its interest in creating additional opportunities around some of these degrees or additional incentives around some of these degrees by steering funding. It's sort of, if you look at sort of authorities that the HEC has, it's certainly one of the most significant, if not the most significant. So, yes, weighting certain degrees in terms of state funding is on the table. During the last legislative session, there was at least one bill, there may have been others, that sought to weight opportunity grants relative to certain fields, a STEM field in that case. Yeah. And, again, that's the kind of discussion that the HEC, I think, will be having in light of this data and other.
And if I could add, Chair Harker, in addition to the differential outcomes you see, there's differential costs of these degrees as well. Mm-hmm. And some of those which are underrepresented and have the greatest potential after graduation are higher costs to deliver. And that's something which I think the universities will probably have more latitude in determining how to structure tuition from here on out to deal with that.
Yeah.
Okay,
sure.
Yes.
Just kind of follow up on that. I'm aware that some private universities are using their financial aid, their advising to sort of steer students into some of these STEM areas. Yeah.
Yeah, good points.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. Tim, as you lead or kind of organize the new troops, if you will, what type of work plan strategy are you going to typically employ? Will you divide into subgroups to attack different areas and so forth, try to do study areas collectively? What's your preferred pathway that you see?
Chair Harker and Representative Johnson, we don't want to become too siloed. We have a particular policy to research for you, a particular project. We'll create work groups. Our work groups will consist of commissioners as well as others who might be voting members or resource persons. So we've done that with the opportunity grant review. We've done that. We're about to do that with Pay It Forward and the other issues related to new ways to ensure affordability and access. But beyond that, we don't want to become too siloed. So we have initially organized one subcommittee focused on student success and another focused on institutional capacity, mission. We're going to have to approve the mission statements of the universities and any significant program change. Your legislation asks us to define significant program change and then approve such changes, as well as a deeper dive into the funding formulas, the potential ways to structure funding for outcomes, and perhaps direct funding. Well, certainly we're going to look deeply at the RAM model, which is what's used in OUS now, and we'll look at the community college formula as well, because our funding formula design, which you've given us the authority to do by rule, is probably the most important thing. And we don't want to separate that from student success. We don't want to separate that from a coordinated network of universities. We don't want, when I say network, I'm using the word intentionally. We stopped using the word system because we feel it's our job to steer all of the, not just our community colleges, institutions for whom we provide direct funding, but attempt to partner with and get maximum contributions from our private colleges and universities as well. So, your point suggests making sure we stay broadly focused on the whole range of issues, and we're trying to do that, Representative.
And a follow-up, and just a comment, but you know, we have given you some guidance on some topics and areas we'd like you to look into. But I also, you know, you have some very creative, innovative, you know, people on your commission now as well, and I hope you will have the latitude to kind of delve into areas as they pop up as well. But I wanted to follow up on the report coming out on Common Core or Common Course numbering. Is that mainly just an evaluation, a census, if you will, of what's going on, let's say, across the country and so forth, and maybe efforts that we've made here, or will it also contain maybe a roadmap or a pathway to how we might get that implemented here in Oregon, along with a timeline attached to it on how, what each step may take?
Yeah, Representative Johnson, Chair Harker, it is both. It both contains a survey of what is occurring in certain other states. It's not a 50-state census, but limited states were surveyed, as well as a discrete set of recommendations to help advance that work in Oregon, principally organized around convening faculty by discipline to organize their expectations relative to learning outcomes, which would facilitate the identical course numbering as a result.
Okay, very good. And one more quick
follow-up. Okay, very quickly.
Related to your last point about trying to redefine or define again what 40-40-20, who it really applies to. And I think we might have different opinions, but I really think the way the system with our P20 continuum set up, I think the traditional student is really who it's identified, because we can impact them as they navigate or as they transition from K to, you know, all on down the line. We have that ability to impact them with policies. It's a little more difficult for those folks that are outside in a non-traditional pathway. So thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Rep. Huffman, and then Rep. Greenlick. We'll get there.
Regarding the review of the opportunity grant, I had worked out an agreement with Dr. Rose in the 13th session. Is that the review that you were talking about, or who's taking the lead on that?
Representative Huffman, Chair Harker, yes, it is that review. And, in fact, the charge that the OEIB adopted to the HAC to do the work substantially mirrors the proposed budget note that you worked with the Chancellor and others on during the legislative session that was not ultimately adopted, in part because we said, hey, look, OEIB wants to do this anyway.
Right.
We'll make it happen. So,
okay.
Yes.
Thanks. Just wanted to keep an eye on where that was.
In a very brief note, I noticed the request for faculty travel to do this. I understand there are modern techniques that you can conference without having to go somewhere. And you might suggest those faculty go to a university where they tend generally to be housed. It's much easier on time and everything else. So one of the things you guys might do is to help point out the university faculty which room they go to get involved in distant learning opportunities for themselves.
I agree with Chair Harker. I think that's an excellent suggestion.
Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next here.
It's always good to have old friends back. And Ken, you're always welcome here. Were you here earlier when we were talking about Future Connect? Is that what we call it, Future Connect?
Yes,
it is what we call it.
Representative Gilliam, Chair Harker, I was
Future Connection
in the office, but had the television on.
As you always do when we're on.
Always.
When you make recommendations, which is you referred to your responsibility of making budget recommendations to the governor, is this too early for your recommendations? In other words, students coming out, or is that part of what you focus on, this group, getting them ready or encouraging them for the first time in their life to think about college?
Representative Gilliam, Chair Harker, if I understand the question, I think I do, then the HEC will, I expect the HEC will be making recommendations between now and the summer to the OEIB and or the governor, and ultimately then to you, for targeted investment in programs perhaps like Future Connect, or initiatives like Future Connect within the post-secondary system. So I think this is absolutely the type of sort of cross-cutting. It's a, you know, K-12 post-secondary investment that yields very positive outcomes consistent with the OEIB's overarching priorities, and I think it would very likely to be on that list for consideration.
Good, because my comment would be, Mr. Chair, that if I understood my colleague right, we passed the bill, they didn't fund it, as you know, they don't let me on Ways and Means, so I don't know if this is true. Mm-hmm. But number one would be to consider in February the possibility of restoring that or moving forward in the new governor's recommended budget on that subject. Yeah. It was my favorite part of this fantastic meeting today, but that, the final student, you should have had her first, the final student just spoke volumes about possibilities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And we're going to let you go now and get this next group up here.
Okay.
Thanks
very
so
good.
Much. Thanks. And thanking you for your patience, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission and immediately open another informational hearing on Teach Oregon. We have Mary Cadiz, Jennifer Robertson, Mark Gerard, I think. Come on up, please. Introduce yourselves for the record and start teaching us.
Good
be right back.
3 hours is a long time.
No, she's going to bring it up.
Take it away, whichever of you, whoever wants to go first.
Okay, I'll lead off and give you some information about the project. And I think you'll be excited to learn that some of the fine work you did in the last legislative session has borne some fruit for this work. This is a unique project, and so I'll introduce myself and then introduce my two co-presenters. I'm Mary Cattis. I'm the director of the Teach Oregon Project for Chalkboard. And Chair Harker and members of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to update you on our work today. This work started earlier this summer. The first question we like to answer is why Teach Oregon? And so it's very much like what you've already heard today. We need to do this to reach our 40-40-20 goal and to close the achievement gap. And this is about getting a high-quality teacher in front of every student in Oregon. And also, we have a demonstrated need. It looks like we'll need to hire from our employment statistics about 16,400 new teachers within the next 7 years, and that's a result of the baby boomers leaving and some growth within our state in our school system. The fourth bullet there you see is a need to create a more diverse and talented teaching workforce, and you heard that earlier in some of your reports. And there's a great effort within these five projects to do that, and a lot of research and work going on with our university partners. And by the way, there are 8 universities involved in this project, 13 school districts, 4 community colleges, and 1 ESD. So the other piece is a financial one, and that is turnover costs associated with attrition of our teachers leaving within the first 5 years is costing our state about $45 million. In many districts, there's close to 40% of the teaching staff that is leaving within the first 5 years. And so the elements of the Teach Oregon project are designed to reduce that cost to the state. We also know that in order to train a really high-quality teacher, we need to give them an extended experience in a school, actually doing teaching under the guidance of a trained clinical teacher who understands adult learning. And so we've begun that with all of the university programs that we're working with in terms of training our clinical teachers in a co-teaching model. And then also providing support early in a teacher's career so that they're successful. That's important. Chalkboard asked the applicants for this project to design 4 blueprints after a year of research looking at what constituted the basis of a high-quality teacher preparation program. This map shows you the programs that have been funded. Chalkboard agreed and committed to fund 3 projects. They did. They funded Portland Metro. They also funded Salem Kaiser and Springfield program. And out of the House Bill 3233 Quality Network money, Network for Quality Teaching and Learning dollars, 2 more were funded through ODE just this last month, and that's Central Oregon Consortium and the PAC-7, which is Tillamook and some of the smaller districts out in that area. This shows you a description of who's involved in each of those projects. Portland Metro has 1 university, 3 school districts. Salem Kaiser, 1 school district, 3 universities. Springfield Immersion, the school district, the U of O, Pacific, and then Lane Community College. And then 2 state-funded projects, the PAC-7, you see the school districts listed there, and they're working with George Fox University, Pacific, Chemeketa Community College, and Tillamook Bay Community College. And then the Central Oregon Consortium is a consortium around OSU, Cascades, and Central Oregon Community College, and the districts that you see listed there. The project deliverables, as we've described them, is to demonstrate a positive impact on student achievement. We know from the national research that a high-quality teacher is the most important factor in student achievement. As I mentioned already, increasing the number of talented and diverse teachers in our workforce, increasing the retention of teacher candidates so that while they're in the pipeline, getting prepared to be a teacher, we don't lose them. And also increasing the skills of our active teachers by having them work as a trained cooperating teacher or a mentor support induction teacher with the new teachers. We are increasing collaboration time between university supervisors and K-12s. This was an easy fix. It mainly involved clustering the student teachers at professional practice schools. So instead of putting two student teachers here, two here, two here, two here, clustering them in a school with trained clinical teachers in that school and keeping the university supervisor there for a longer period of time and reducing their travel costs. We are also looking at improving incentives for cooperating and clinical teachers who are working with students. That we've been all over the map with that with our university program. Some universities paying $75 for a teacher to host a student teacher in their classroom. Others paying $150, $250, and so on. And so we're having a lot of discussion about what does that look like and what can we do about that. Also, another important part of these projects, and this is a common thread across all five projects, is a clear process for revising the course syllabi and making sure that what the students are learning in their university teacher preparation courses are translating over to the classroom and they have the opportunity to practice those skills in the classroom so that there's that connect. They get seed. It's the way I understand it to be taught. When I try it with students, does it work? And then being able to be part of that process in the schools. Also, another important piece of this will be to provide evaluative information back to our university partners on program recommendations and ways that we can improve our programs. This is the logic model. We're working with Eco Northwest as the evaluation group on all five projects. And by the way, ODE has asked Chalkboard to go ahead and manage the two state-funded projects with the same accountability measures and the same criteria as we're using on the ones that have been funded by the Chalkboard project. So they'll be under the same thing. And you can see that our ultimate outcome is higher student achievement, intermediate outcome, effective teachers. You can skip that one. Okay. So our evaluation components will be looking both at process and we'll also be looking at impact. We'll be looking at what happened in terms of process so we know how to scale up these projects and replicate them. We also, of course, will be looking at the quantitative questions about, so how well did it work? Did it get the kind of results that we want? This is a timeline. The PAC-7, Portland, and Salem are just a little bit further along than Central Oregon and Springfield, but this is just showing you a graphic of a timeline. Our status update, all our coaches are trained. They're working with the five teams. Our teams have met with Eco Northwest. They've got the deliverables down, that those conversations are still going on. They've set up definitive timelines and targets, and those targets are quantifiable targets. So when you look at a target, for example, it would be something akin to when we put a teacher candidate on an extended residency in a classroom with a teacher trained to work with that teacher in a clinical model, do we get a better result, more student growth, and more student achievement than we do in the traditional model? And Mark's going to give you a good comparison over how the traditional model and the new models that we're proposing compare. We also have teams researching several areas, professional development schools, or if you're in Central Oregon, you will hear the term professional practice schools. They're the same things. And looking at hiring and placement strategies, again, very similar to the report you already had about how do we encourage a more diverse workforce, how do we help students move into that. Some of these projects also have teacher cadet programs in them, so we're looking at our minority students in middle school. We're getting them involved in a teacher cadet model similar to one that was used in South Carolina. Matter of fact, Salem-Keizer has 100 students. The majority of those 100 students in 7th and 8th grade are minority students who are taking classes at their middle schools, three of the middle schools in Salem. curriculum, who are looking at moving toward teacher preparation. Of course, a lot of the conversations are about college, and those conversations are involving their parents in terms of how do we prepare for this. You're 7th and 8th grade now. It's not too early to start having those conversations. Co-teaching training has been completed in 3 of the 5 projects. We're developing evaluation tools so that as districts hire our teacher candidates, they understand where the strengths are and where that teacher still needs to grow. One of the things we recognize is that teachers' growth is over the entire continuum of their career. You don't just walk out of the university and say, wow, I'm a teacher, although it felt like that. I remember when I first was handed the keys to my classroom 40-plus years ago, I was told, well, good luck. And we're trying to change that model a little bit now. This is just a shot of probably the richest thing, and Jennifer will speak to this, is the work of this many universities, teams, and school districts working together. When you bring that kind of talent together, you can't help but create change and get some good results. And so I'm going to turn the time over to my two colleagues, and let's go ahead and start with Mark. He's going to talk with you a little bit about how this new model that's being proposed through the projects looks to a dean of college of education.
Good morning, Chair Harker and members of the committee. Thanks so much for having us. My name is Mark Girard. I'm serving as the interim dean of the College of Education at Western Oregon University. And Western's been involved in this Salem-Keizer collaborative work with Corbin University and Willamette and Salem-Keizer for almost 3 years now, preceding this infusion of capital from Teach Oregon. So we're pleased that we're making headway fairly rapidly. I'd just like to tell a little bit of a story here that contrasts the way teacher preparation has been done sort of historically, sort of the default model, versus what we're trying to do now. And I think you'll agree that what we're trying to do is right-minded. At the same time, this speaks to one of the major findings of the Secretary of State's audit report on teacher preparation in public universities. Specifically, the finding that states very clearly, Oregon's public teaching colleges can do more to strengthen student teaching. And that's very much in line with the professional field. Lots of serious attention on using that student teaching experience more systematically. Frankly, it used to be the approach was sort of make the assignment, cross your fingers, and hope for the best. And we're just trying to be more systematic in that regard. So let me just contrast a couple things here. One of the first things we did was right now that default model, 15 weeks of full-time student teaching is what's required in the state of Oregon. We've committed to 30 weeks of student teaching. Huge difference already. The emphasis has historically been on sort of the training of the teacher. In this new model, the emphasis is on student learning. Of course, supporting student learning through the preparation of a higher quality of teachers. Historically, mentor teachers were selected by interest and availability, and frankly, not always the best teachers identified to be mentors to novices. Frankly, sometimes those assignments were made to support low-performing teachers. Well, let's give that person a student teacher, and perhaps that will inspire them in some way. Well, now we're seeking to place teachers with mentors with demonstrated competence in mentoring, specialized skills around coaching, and using evidence-based practices. And that comes through, at least in our model with Teach Oregon, our clinical teachers are participating in a week-long clinical teacher academy held in the summer, where all of these skills are developed, and specific skills around co-teaching, which is a strategy where both the mentor teacher and the teacher candidate are both in front of the classroom, both working with children simultaneously. And it doesn't take a great leap in logic to believe that good things will happen if you double the number of adults focused on student learning in a classroom.
Yes, thank you. Real quick, Dean, is the teacher's the licensing people, you're going to go from 15 to 30 now? Is that, we don't have to do this, do we have to vote on that? Or that's a big increase to go from 15 weeks to 30 weeks, especially I'm thinking of people who've been out and working and want to come back and teach, and now you're saying you got to go over a half a year of student teaching versus 15 weeks. Sometimes quality and quantity get sort of is that a law now? Is that just part of the program that these people have agreed to?
Chair Harker, Representative Wisnant, thank you for, let me clarify. We've made that commitment internally to this for this project. The state of Oregon has not made that shift over to 30 weeks, no.
If you're accepting going in, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
If you're going into this program, you're accepting that you're going to do.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Exactly. So thank you for that. Several other things here. Mentor-teacher training, minimal training and minimal support in this default model, rigorous support, rigorous training. Our universities have, through support from this grant, have committed to assigning more time for a university person to spend at site as we're clustering more student teachers in a single building to be there, to be a support, to help students negotiate the culture of that building, more involvement from a building principal as the culture setter in a building, and we've got lots of great stories already where these university liaison folks are able to step in. They all have teaching licenses themselves. They can step in, provide teachers opportunities to meet in small groups in ways that they haven't had time and space to do previously. So this seems like a good thing. The last thing I want to point out is that historically, student-teacher evaluation has sort of happened infrequently and idiosyncratically, depending on what happens in that university. And in this project, we've been able to align the evaluation materials and the evaluation models for pre-service teachers. They're now held to the same standards that our practicing teachers are held to, evaluated using the same language, using the same instrument. So the conversations about teacher professional development, both at the pre-service level and for teachers that are in the pipeline, they're talking about the same things, and this just supports a level of development that's really important. So impact, as Mary mentioned, we have a strong evaluation framework in place, but these two innovations in particular, co-teaching, adding additional adults in a classroom focused on student learning, and a systematic mentoring system for novices. I'm inclined to believe those are just good things independent of what our data may share for us. So, thank you.
Which boxes?
Sure. Chair Harker, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for having us. My name is Jennifer Roberts. I am a coach for the Teach Oregon Project, working with Chalkboard. From my perspective as a coach, I just wanted to share with you what we're already learning in this amazing work. Teach Oregon is providing a mechanism and momentum through which teachers and principals, teacher education faculty, and district administrators are having really meaningful conversations about the present and the future of teacher excellence in Oregon. This project has created space in which we can equally interested and committed parties are coming together. They're setting aside our personal agendas, thinking long-term about the kinds of teachers that we need in our state. Teach Oregon's team, teams across the state, we're doing amazing work independently, but we're also now coming together and sharing those lessons learned. We're really united in this vision for teacher education and teacher excellence. We're having an enormous impact on student achievement, and our goals in Teach Oregon are singular in that focus, that we support teachers to be excellent in their craft, and they will support students to be excellent in theirs. Teach Oregon's focus on promoting the diverse and dedicated teacher workforce benefits all students, all citizens of Oregon, and I'm so excited to be a part of this work. We're already working towards the opportunity to support the vision of the diverse and talented teacher workforce, and our partnerships are breaking down the barriers and the boundaries to allow for the recruitment and preparation of a teacher workforce that is reflective of our Oregon citizenry, a workforce that has the supports necessary to become effective educators, but also a workforce that can sustain and thrive in a challenging profession, which is not an easy thing to do today. Our guiding message is that through our conversations is that we have a common vision and that we're now sharing in these very meaningful and trusting relationships with each other across our institutions, something that has not happened in a very long time in education. Our work is just beginning, but I feel like we're already making a huge impact. Our logic model provides a systematic mechanism for long-term change, and I think that's why it really has tremendous power. We're looking at that entire continuum of the teacher workforce pipeline. We're identifying talented future teachers early. We're dedicating the attention that they need to support them into the higher education system. We're bolstering their experiences as they learn how to teach, and then we're supporting them after they enter the profession in ways that are meaningful. We're closing that feedback loop in ways that have direct impact now and will continue to matter in the future. We thank you for your support of Teach Oregon, and we welcome any questions that you might have about our work.
Thank you very much, all of you, for being here. It is an exciting project. You mentioned how exciting it is to be in the middle of this, and the need is great, and I really like a lot about the approach that's being taken here. Thanks to all of you and your colleagues for doing this. I apologize for the tight timeline here. Rep. Johnson, you have a question or a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I also wish we had had more a portion of our agenda for this topic, but great.
There will be more meetings.
Thank you. I'm assuming with all of the different changes in policies and direction and so forth in education and what's going on in the classroom, i.e. we're now in the post-House Senate Bill 290 environment, we're talking about, you know, Common Core implementation across the board, that teachers are being taught how to be successful in this new proficiency-driven type of classroom environment, which is way different than bring the whole herd along at the same speed type environment. But specifically about 290, I'm hoping that we're creating the expectation that teachers, the teachers of tomorrow, will be in an environment where there will be regular and robust evaluations to make sure that they're on track and that they have support that they need, but also that they're setting goals for themselves and then setting goals for their student growth as well. So I'm assuming that's a part of what you're unfolding, and knowing chalkboards involved, that that's all a part of the curriculum as you try to raise up this next generation.
Yeah, that's a huge part, and we've spent a lot of time thinking about ways that systems in teacher education mirror the systems within our K-12 institutions, and so that process of learning how to teach is seamless across that continuum. Mm-hmm. So our evaluation tools are aligned. We're talking about the same standards. We're talking about the same types of processes so that it doesn't look different in teacher ed than it does once they become hired in a school district,
very good.
Which is really important.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Thank you very much.
So I will close that informational hearing and adjourn this committee meeting for today.
Good job,
for today.
Good job,
and adjourn this committee meeting.